All right, thank you. A pleasure to be with you, as usual. And, you know, I guess we're on about a minute early. I've been not complaining, really, because the fine show that precedes this one, Motor City Riffs, where you get to hear the music coming out of the Motor City that is one day, just like music for the last 30 or 40 years, has become world music. You get to hear it first here on Motor City Riffs. So I kind of, you know, it's been going sometimes even to like 5 after the hour. So I say to Jay Hudson, who's the producer of this show and the co-host of Motor City Riffs, and Doug Podell, our midday guy and our program director, can I say, you know, I'm about just right at 11 o'clock. So they now got me on a minute early. Well, this isn't network TV, so whatever. If you ever tune in and it's like 2 or 3 after, 4 minutes after, something like that, and you're hearing rock and roll, or you're hearing some spots, some ads, you know that I'm going to be on in a minute. Anyways, lots to talk about. I was thinking, you know, the last time I did a full-time talk show, I kept doing this show and the interview shows that accompany it right through the time that I was also doing a full-time nationally syndicated talk show. I didn't come into Detroit. I mean, that was part of the deal. I mean, my bosses are so sweet. They said, okay, as long as you don't compete with us, as long as we don't want you here in Detroit on some other station taking audience away from us, but as long as you're in these, I was always in fairly small towns, a lot of Santa Cruz, Santa Fe, places like that, sort of medium to small markets. It was called the IE America Radio Network. And actually, truth be told, it was how, well, truth be told, I said I was going to tell the truth, but it was a train wreck. It was actually a train wreck. It was all liberal, progressive, leftist, insane, anarchist. I mean, those are different categories. I won't tell you which the categories I fill. You can just guess. Anyways, so I was so fried after that. Not so much from doing the show, although it's pretty intense. I know this one of these stupid bosses I had said, "Well, you only work 3 hours a day," because that's how long the talk show was. But I mean, my wife was saying, "Gee, you know, you're working like 16 hours a day almost," because it was pretty intense work. I mean, I'm not complaining about that. What I'm complaining about was just that it was run so poorly, and that the capacity that was there, the potential, just was never met. And I thought, this is it, man. I'm not just never getting myself in a situation like that. I mean, I was really fried. And I thought, you know, I have this show. I love all you folks. I've been doing this for decades. You know, I've got this website that gets hundreds of thousands of hits. I don't need to communicate anymore. And increasingly, there's at least, there's not insane anarchist talk radio out there on a regular basis, but there is a lot of liberal talk radio now and progressive talk radio, and I think it's going to grow. I mean, a minimum of half the country is interested in that, and not this far-out, far-right-wing crap that's been dominating the airwaves for so many years now. And essentially, as I always say, it's toxic to the community, because it really fosters a lot of negative attitudes. Anyway, I mean, you can be negative towards politicians. I don't care about that. I'm very negative towards most politicians, including most Democratic politicians. And I'm just over the edge with the current crop of far-right-wing Republicans. But give me some Democrats. Get some Democrats in as president, and, you know, the majority in the Senate, and watch me go on them. Okay, it's a talk show. Peter Werbe is my name, 313-298-WRIF, and you can email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That's actually left over from that daily show I was doing. My website is peterwerbe.com, PETERWERBE.com. A lot of the items we're going to be talking about today, and hopefully you're going to be commenting on, are featured there. In other words, this is kind of the talky stuff part of it. The more extensive written stuff is on the website. And let's see, if you're far away, you're either listening on WRIF.com or RadioPower.org, and RadioPower.org will rebroadcast this program at 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. tomorrow, that's Eastern Time, and then the whole kit and caboodle will be archived at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Now, those of you that start this show at the beginning know that I go through this kind of show business in a way, and the business of the show, I should say. And I was thinking, because, you know, some people, I mean, there's got to be people that get off work at, say, midnight, and they hear the show from midnight till 20 after 12. That's it. That's all they ever hear, because they're listening in the car. It means they never hear any of this. So I don't know. Maybe I should scatter this stuff around. All right, a number of big stories, and not in order of importance, although one has to recognize one's audience, particularly here in the WRIF immediate listening area. And that has to do with the Supreme Court decision on Monday, 6-3 decision, that said people that smoke marijuana because their doctors have prescribed it in those 10 states where it has been made legal, they do it to ease pain or to increase appetite in people that are doing chemotherapy or to reduce glaucoma pressure and what have you. The court held that federal law supersedes any state law, and there can be a continuation of prosecutions of people using medical marijuana, even in those states where the voters, and has it all been voters? I don't think so. I think there has been a number of states where the legislature has said that it's okay. And I thought what was interesting was that and there's a lot of little interesting wrinkles, and this isn't just about marijuana or medical marijuana. It's a whole thing about states' rights versus federalism and all that. And if any of you want to make comments on that, fine. I'm not going to bring it up myself. 313-298-WRIF. Now, what was interesting, though, the justices expressed sympathy for the two seriously ill California women who brought the case, and the majority agreed that federal agents may arrest even sick people. Now, speaking of sick people, most of the really, these are ill people, terminal people, sometimes like in Santa Cruz, where I said I used to broadcast into, and we went out there was a marijuana hospice. People grew their own marijuana there. They didn't even buy it through the growers clubs that are out there and legal and permitted. So this hospice was filled with gravely ill and dying people. And John Ashcroft, remember that wacko that was that lost the Senate race in 2000 to a dead man on the ballot? Someone had already died. And so Bush then put him in as his attorney general. Well, he organized a raid on this marijuana hospice in 2003 or early 2004. I mean, and one of the, in fact, you'll hear this in an interview if you're going to stay up a while. One of the federal agents was heard to say, as they were dragging away these frail people, ill with grave and diseases that were pretty soon going to be lethal, one of the federal agents said, "What are we doing?" Yeah, and that is the question. And in a lot of ways, that's what the justices of the Supreme Court have said. What are we doing? What are we doing, particularly in the case of medical marijuana? And John Paul Stevens, the associate justice who wrote the lead opinion, essentially said, hey, Congress, address this problem. Address this problem. Let me see here. Steve Fox is the director of the government relations for the Marijuana Policy Project. And he said, this decision does not overturn any state medical marijuana law or take away any protection those laws provide. In fact, they do not anticipate that there's going to be a lot of raids. Bush's popularity is so low right now, the idea that they're going to start busting sick and terminally ill people is not going to exactly increase his popularity. Anybody see the Letterman top 10, what Bush could do to increase his popularity? Number two was resign, and everybody cheered in the audience. Let's see. Justice Stevens went out of his way to note in the majority opinion that, quote, marijuana does have valid therapeutic purposes, and gave a strong suggestion that Congress should act. It will be able to do so next week when Representative Maurice Hinchey, Democrat of New York, and Representative Dana Rohrabacher, Republican of California, will propose an amendment to the Justice Department Appropriations Bill that will bar the department from attacking patients in states where medical marijuana is legal. And he says, this is, again, Steve Fox from the Marijuana Policy Project, we've already seen the blowback from this decision. On June 7th, the Rhode Island Senate voted to pass their medical marijuana bill by 34-2, by far the largest state legislative vote ever in favor of a medical marijuana bill. All right. So this does affect our health. We're not talking about the libertarian view that the political state has no right to determine what we do to ourselves if there are not other people harmed. What is that? Oh, you can help me with this one. The only law shall be do what harm no one, do what they... In other words, you can... I can't remember that. Someone... Am I... clear enough? Did I get that out enough? The law of the land or something like that, hurt no, do what you want, but hurt no one. Come on, it's much more eloquent than that. It might even be, ready for this, pagans. Pagans might have said that. Anyways, do you remember, I don't know, maybe a year ago, I was on a panel with Nolan Finley, who's the editorial director of the Detroit News. Far right winger, real creep. I mean, I had it out with him, even to the point where he, behind the moderator's back, whispered to me, F you, like that. I thought, wow, I've done some work here. Anyways, he's always on the wrong side, as far as, you know, not my side, but what I would consider the wrong side of every single social question, just like his newspaper. Anyways, he says, I'm a taxpayer who expects a return on his investment. The drug war is delivering none. Nobel Prize winner Milton Friedman joined 500 respected economists last week in endorsing a Harvard University study that said federal and state governments could realize a $14 billion gain by regulating and taxing marijuana as a legal product. There is a growing acceptance that the war on drugs is not only unwinnable, it is irrational. Well, most of you listening knew that. War on drugs? I can't even drive on drugs. I know. You've heard that before. From me. Anyways, all right. So this is something that affects people to different degrees. Certainly, the medical marijuana people that are ill have another. If this was to be legal, would have another source of medication. And worse, though, is I don't know. It's hard to say which is worse. The idea that over the last two generations, millions of people have become criminals for smoking flowers is just horrible, and will go down with as foolishness in the same manner that Prohibition in the 1920s did. So I never thought that I would see in my lifetime some sensible drug policy to understand. You know, actually, I'm giving away this whole interview that's going to happen at 1 a.m. Going to be talking with Ethan Nadelman of the Drug Policy Alliance, and we're going to be talking about that decision. More life and death issues, though. 313-298-WRIF, by the way, if you'd like to join the discussion, Jay Hudson will pick up your call and as our phone screener as well as our producer here. Let's see. What is happening? Jay, write me a note here. Why do these calls come on and then drop off? Are they just I don't know. What are they doing? Anyways, in the area of life and death in Iraq, the murderous assault, sort of a war of all against all, isn't it, with the United States in the middle of it, George Bush having precipitated it with a big lie. We know more and more because of these memos that have come out from the Brits that Bush was bound and determined to attack Iraq, and there never was the slightest. In fact, what they did, they decided to invade Iraq to get rid of Saddam Hussein, to install the United States as the imperial power that ruled Iraq because of its oil resources. And all of this is coming out now. And the polls overwhelmingly show that the losses are unacceptable. The U.S. military toll in Iraq has crossed 1,700. So we're now at 1,701 dead Americans, 12,000 or 13,000 American wounded. Who knows how many Iraqis? There's some evidence to say that there's 100,000. And when I had some conservative on there, not 100,000, you're believing the, it's only 25,000. Well, that's a huge mountain of corpses to be based on this vile lie that the Bush administration invented. But the military announced a killing of four more U.S. soldiers on Sunday, pushing the American death toll past 1,700. Now, there's a couple of things. Oh, yeah, I thought this was pretty interesting. There's an organization called Gold Star Families for Peace. These are families that have lost members. And Cindy Sheehan Cindy Sheehan is the co-founder of it. And it's also, by the way, Gold Star Families for Peace is a member organization of AfterDowningStreet.org. AfterDowningStreet.org. If you know nothing about this, I wouldn't blame you too much because this has not been getting the play in the media that it should have. But there are memos. This is the Downing Street memo out of the Tony Blair's residence, where it was the Brits were concerned. Well, you know, the Americans are going to war. We've signed on, and there's no justification. We've got to find one. So Bush invents. I mean, I doubt if he did, but you know, his people that have his hand up his back that were animating him at that time said, well, they've got weapons of mass destruction. Right? So here's what Cindy Sheehan says. The evidence is overwhelming that George Bush wanted to invade Iraq at all costs, and the lack of intelligence giving him a reason for going to war didn't stop him. Iraq posed no threat to the United States, but this didn't get in the way of Bush's and Blair's plans. The Downing Street memo is a smoking gun that proves the intelligence was, quote, fixed around the policy. Tens of thousands of innocent people, including my son, Specialist Casey Sheehan, are dead because of these deceits. This is what his mother says. If you're ringing, hang on. Jay will get you in just a second. Yesterday, Bush claimed, you know, one of the hardest things I do as president is to try to comfort families who've lost a loved one in combat. That's what Bush said. That one of the hardest things I do as president, well, he said, you know, one of the hardest things I do as president is try to comfort families who lost a loved one in combat. Responded Sheehan, who has lost her son. George Bush met with my family in June of 2004. He was ostensibly there to give our family some comfort, but his Tea Party attitude, his cavalier inappropriate comments, and his lack of respect for our family and my son were more hurtful than comforting. We left the meeting even more distraught. If he cares about our troops and our families, why has he never attended a funeral? Why doesn't he sign the so-called death letters that are sent to the families of fallen soldiers? I think those are some pretty good questions. Bush, before the invasion of wars, the invasion of Iraq, said on March 6, 2003, I don't like war. That's why I first went to the United Nations to begin with. He says, another time, March 8th, he says, we're doing everything we can to avoid war in Iraq. These are total lies. They are total lies. They had planned to go to war, and they had to find the excuse. And when any time it looked like there was not going to be the rationale for war, they circumvented whatever they had to circumvent. Like at the end, when there had to be a UN resolution, it wasn't forthcoming, and Bush knew that the inspectors would find that Saddam Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction. That's when the United States had to attack. Well, it's not doing well for our army. The army has missed its recruiting goal for the fourth month in a row, and getting only 75% of it. And it's at 75% of its May goal of recruiting 6,700. Well, the only reason they've gotten that is because they reduced it from 8,000. They said, well, we changed our goal. In the meantime, people can't even get mustered out. People are getting two and three tours of this hellhole. It's 111 over there now, by the way. Now, here's what the Army's doing. The Army wants to double the top cash bonus for new recruits to $40,000 in an effort to stem a continued recruiting shortfall in the midst of the Iraq War. This is USA Today. 40 grand. I mean, put another 10 grand on it, and I might volunteer. Imagine that. $40,000. So this is no longer a volunteer army in the sense that we've been told. It's a mercenary army. People are going to be joining not to volunteer to serve our country or even to get training like many people have in the past, but simply to cash in on $40,000 or a program that would provide up to $50,000 in home mortgages to help recruits who sign up for 8 years of active duty. This is just amazing. Also, Army recruiting are going to be recruiting more high school dropouts to meet goals. Now, Guy, I love high school dropouts. I was one of them, so I'm not disparaging anyone. But normally, when you drop out of high school, it's an indication of problems in some level or another. And there was with me. Maybe some other time I'll go into it, or maybe I never will. But in any event... they're now saying, well, used to be high school graduates, now high school dropouts. And they're also lowering the test scores. This is how desperate the Army has become for recruits. And the reason people aren't joining is they know that this is a fool's errand. They know that they could come back. 1,700 people out of the 140,000, your odds are pretty good. But when you start adding in the injured and the people without legs and the people without faces and the people without insides, you're starting to get up towards 15,000. That's getting around 10% of the people that are there at any, that's over 10% of what are there at any given time. Buzzflash.com. I would suggest going there every day. B-U-Z-Z, Flash, buzzflash.com. Or you can go to my site and hook in from there. And they've got just, in fact, one of these articles came from there about the recruiters, and they always have their own sort of headlines. Here's what they had for the one about missing the recruiting goal. Army misses recruiting goal for fourth month. It's getting drafty around here with D-R-A-F-T. Wonder how many, you know, the few of you who still support this war in our draft age, I wonder how, you know, swift you'd be on it if you were all of a sudden going to be drafted and taken over there. Buzzflash said, oh, just draft the young Republicans who are so gung-ho about the war as they drive around in their Lexus cars bought by their papas. Send them all to the front lines tomorrow along with the Bush twins. That will end the war quickly. All right. Peter Werbe here with you on Night Call, 313-298-WRIF. And, hey, let's take some calls. This is a talk show. And here from Jackson, Michigan, is Curtis. Hi, it's Peter Werbe.
Hello.
Hi.
How's it going?
Great.
I listen to your show just when I come out to catch a buzz. Just wanted to let you all know that.
Okay. Because you're a glaucoma sufferer, right?
No, just a normal, average, everyday guy.
Okay.
But, anyways, I just wanted to say that as far as smoking weed goes, I don't understand the chemicals that they give to you now, say, to compensate the problems that these people are having for illnesses. They're finding out every day because they're not testing them long enough. You know, 5 years down the road, they're finding out every single day a pill is doing something negative to somebody. So it's just funny how they don't go with the natural thing. Of course, all the high-ons believe that you know, the government won't legalize it because everybody can grow it in their backyard. So what kind of profit or money could they...
Well, you know what? Actually, I was thinking about that. I was reading that earlier about those 500 professors or whoever were saying that the United States could, by regulating and taxing it, make $14 billion a year. I mean, aren't people just going to grow it in their backyard?
Yeah, easily. I mean, I hate to say it, but when I was a younger kid, I would never do this now because I have a family, even though I still do it. But I'd never grow it anymore just because of the liability. But I did when I was younger, and you wouldn't believe the 10-foot plants I would grow. They were unbelievable.
The high-ons. I like that. Hey, what's this deal? I've never heard this in my life, everyone talking about 420.
The only reason why I know what that is from asking myself, because I admit to use a pot. I've never used any other drug ever.
Wait a minute. You asked yourself something you didn't know and got an answer?
Yeah, it was a mixture of cocaine and pot together, which you smoke it, and it's like basically smoking soft crack is what most people say.
That's what 420 is?
Yeah, as far as I know,
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure I'm right about that.
But okay.
You'll get another call. And
all right, well, we can find out. Thank you, Curtis. Thanks for joining us. I can see what this, you know, people dead in Iraq, let's talk about reefer. 313-298-WRIF. Usually I say, when we've talked about this in the past, that I don't want to hear, I always think this WRIF audience, probably 70-80%, maybe more, maybe 90% would support legalization of marijuana, and for sure, medical marijuana. So maybe it should be people who don't think we should, could actually come up with some good reasons why it shouldn't be. I mean, what Curtis was talking about is absolutely the case. I mean, all of it, we come to find out that these drug companies, and I don't want to say the drug company names because I might associate the wrong one, but they've been involved in some pretty dastardly deeds in hiding the ill effects of their drugs like Vioxx and all that. You know how many people died last year from smoking marijuana? Zero, year before that. I don't want to keep going back endlessly, but it's zero. People don't die from smoking marijuana. It's impossible. But with, I think it was like Vioxx, like 135,000 people died. Or was it 30? Okay. You know, don't have it in front of me. And I've been kind of defensive lately because people a couple times said, well, you know, you were wrong on this. I said, this is all off the top of my head. So let's say it's 35,000 people died. I might even have been 135,000 people, but a lot of people have died, and all of this information was suppressed in the same way that the tobacco companies knew the effect of tobacco. All right. Where are we going? I don't know. I don't have anything marked here. So I'm just going to go to Sandy in Beverly Hills. Sandy, hey, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Sandy. Hey. Okay. Sandy isn't really getting it, so tell him or her what's up and how to do that, because we're on a delay. So hopefully, yeah, let me talk to Mike in Westland. Hey, Mike, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Mike, wait. Mike, let me ask you a question. Can you hear the show on hold now when you're on hold waiting?
Yes.
Good. Okay, go ahead. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, not a problem. First, I want to apologize if I lose the connection and we get lost in discussion, but I'm out driving home from work, actually, from out of state.
Okay.
So, but first, I want to say that I served in the military for 2 years, back in 1996 and 1997, and I was forced out on a medical because they discovered that I had heart problems.
Wow.
Well, thank God for that. But I want to tell you, you made a comment about mercenary. We're going to have a military of mercenaries. You really have that now. And I say that because even when I was in back in the late 90s,
yeah,
a lot of the people that went in, now I served in the Navy, but I knew a lot of people from that I graduated high school with who went into the Army or the Marines because it was a big push, you know, and even though they were cutting back, there was, you know, great training, great this, great that. But the problem they had was that once they got out of the military, all they had was their money because there was so many hoops that people had to jump through to try to get GI Bill, money for training, and all that stuff. I mean, yeah, some people got what they were looking for, got the money that they needed for school, but it was kind of a crock.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I got lucky that I was able to get a little bit of money for training because I was out on a medical, so I wasn't able to stay in, and they believed, and they've never really concluded, that it was maybe because of medications that I had been given while I was in the military.
Wow.
A bad concoction of medicines.
Well, is the VA taking care of you, I hope?
Yeah, I'm being taken care of. Yes, that's not a problem.
Good.
Actually, I haven't had any reoccurrences of the problems that they discovered. And so I'm probably going to be booted out here soon because I'm a relatively young gentleman. I'm only 28.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to the mercenary thing, because I know I've kind of wandered, the people that were there they would fake their high school diplomas, which is easy to do because color copiers. I could fake a high school diploma, and luckily I didn't have to, but I knew people that did.
Really?
They took my high school diploma, even with the primitive scanners, and I hate to say primitive because it was high tech then, but you could scan in the document to a computer, change the name, the computer recognizes the font, you print it out with a color inkjet printer.
There you go.
And you have your fake high school diploma. Now, the military then wasn't looking to see if it was a real. They just looked at your they glanced at your transcript, if you had a high ASVAB score, and you had a piece of paper. That's what they looked at, and they signed you up on the spot. And a lot of them did it just to get the training. Now, yeah, there were a lot of people that I met when I was in training camp that were gung-ho. Yes, we're going to protect the country. And I was kind of that way, but I was also there for the, hey, I can get money out of this when I'm done and get training.
Well, yeah. I think everybody probably went in with a mix other than a few. Also, it probably depends on what branch of the service. Probably get the most gung-ho guys going in to the Marines. But it takes a different quality when suddenly you're offering a substantial chunk of change. I mean, I was all kidding when I said that people, if you're just tuning in, what we're talking about, the Army may offer $40,000 to recruits because of the recruitment goals are not being met, and I said, well, gee, make it 50 and maybe I would volunteer.
Oh no, I heard you say that, and I understand that it's in half jest. If I could go back for the hiring bonus, I would. And my thing is, though, is I don't see it as a lot of people can put whatever spin they want on it, because everybody's opinion is going to be different, Peter. But my thing is, back when I went in, it would have been nice to have something like this, because God only knows what could have happened to me if I hadn't found out while I was on base that I had a problem.
Well, yeah, and I don't know, maybe you can apply for it retroactively. All right, Mike, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Here is Randy in Toledo, Ohio. Randy, hi. It's Peter Werby on WRIF.
Hi, Peter. This is the first time I've ever heard your show. I enjoy it. I think you're right on target on a number of things.
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to say, though, I listened to Curtis and Jackson. I think 420, and I might be mistaken about this, but from what I know, 420 is the police numerical reference to marijuana.
Oh, really?
And so it's kind of like a nickname, you know.
Well, I think he's
electronic, et cetera.
Curtis, yeah, Curtis said he thought he was 100% right. I didn't want to be rude and say
I don't think so.
No, I think he's go ahead.
I think it's a police designation for marijuana or marijuana-related offenses, et cetera. And kids are picking it up and just saying, hey, you know, you got me 420, that kind of thing.
That's cool.
But my real point was about the war. You are absolutely right on target. And the biggest disappointment is the lack of outrage coming from, you know, Democrats or progressives or really even moderate Republicans. I mean, what is this country thinking? I mean, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind, and I have voted Republican in the past, that this person, that we were completely misled by the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like we just haven't reached that threshold of whatever that magic number is of deaths and casualties that people are going to just be absolutely outraged. And until it touches everybody in the community or everybody in the country, I think it's going to continue.
Well, it's starting to with the death rate of U.S. soldiers and injury rate. Well, you know, depending on the Democratic Party for real opposition, it ain't going to happen. I mean, that's one of the problems with the Kerry candidacy. He was so equivocal. And what's always changed things dramatically in this country is mass movements of people. I mean, most of us don't like to get out and demonstrate or what have you. But when the official channels of change or of even speaking in a direct way to power are closed, well, then we have to kind of invent our own little systems.
Well, and every year, exactly right, because a lot of the things that the Bush government is doing, including some things on tort reform, et cetera, are just an obstacle for the typical average American person being able to go and redress their government. And dissent is no longer considered a virtue in this country. It's considered, you know, an ultimate sin. And you're seeing people in that administration that are going and dropping like flies, because they, you know, happened to bring up that maybe the war is going to cost $300 billion, $400 billion, whatever. They rode that poor guy out of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for even suggesting that it
sure
would be that much.
Yeah, now it's $1 billion a week we're spending.
I know. And the other thing I wanted to say, and I'll let you go because I'm sure you have a lot of people trying to get to you, is I have to give kudos to the woman, I think you said her name was Sheehan, who is saying that her son was died for a senseless matter. And it's
mm-hmm.
a very difficult thing. You know, it's hard enough to lose a son or a daughter in that situation and deal with it. And I think what happens a lot is that the parents rationalize this and say, well, it was for a great cause, and we need to keep going on. Well, you know what? It was senseless, and that's being ultimately honest. And psychologically, I think you're just playing mind games with yourself if you believe that this is some noble cause that we're after here.
Now,
all it is to justify your loss.
If you want to see that quote, you can go to accuracy.org. Accuracy.org, and it's actually, I don't know what you'd call it, a project that provides guests for talk shows, but it has a public website. And they send me the phone numbers. I think just the email is there. But it's accuracy.org, and if you go to their press releases and go to June 8th, you'll see that. And let me see. Gold Star Families for Peace.org. It's GSFP. But you can go to accuracy.org. Actually, they got an enormously interesting people and guests, and some of them I put on this program at 1 a.m. here. Well, and Mike,
I'll check it out. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate you calling. Thanks for calling in, Randy, rather, from Toledo, Ohio. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
This is WRIF.com. Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-4255. 1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Motor City Harley Davidson Harley Fest 2005, presented by 101 WRIF Moulton and Jerome Duncan Ford. Your chance to nab a 2005 Harley Davidson Custom XL 883 Sportster.
Yes.
Then park it in the driveway next to a sweet new Ford Harley Davidson F250 truck, and a glove box stuffed with $5,000 in cold hard cash.
Compliments of Rock Financial.
Just keep your radio locked on 101 The Rift to win a key, along with tickets to see Tesla Friday, June 17th. Also, listen for details on Harley bike nights around the Motor City, where you can grab a key in person. Harley Fest 2005, presented by Motor City Harley Davidson.
Feel the freedom at the number one dealer, located in Farmington Hills.
Moulton,
making friends in 1786.
Jerome Duncan Ford,
Michigan's number one Ford dealer.
Security provided by Gallagher Security. Train professionals for crowd safety and management.
101 WRIF.
Rift rocks.
Detroit's rock station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Clubhouse Tavern, located in the fabulous Fisher Building, offering great food at great prices. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. And I'm getting a lot of email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, clearing up what that phrase 420 means to vipers. That's a term like from the 30s, where marijuana smokers were called vipers by themselves. Jason writes in, and if you guys want, guys and gals, I'm always curious what city you're calling from, writing from, if you want. 420, says Jason, is a California police code that means pot smoking in progress. We have a 420 in the corner of such and such, and also no legalization. He says, I wouldn't want the government or Philip Morris to grow my pot. Who wants to smoke pesticides? Decriminalization would be ideal, but who wants to pay more taxes or any taxes for that matter when it's used for murder? Also, I don't know if you're aware of Utah Phillips, but if you haven't checked him out, he's an old wobbly and an anarchist folk musician you'll love. Well, I do know who Utah Phillips is, and a wobbly is a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, one of the few radical trade unions. It's celebrating its 100th centenary. 100th centenary. That would make it 10,000 or 1,000. You want to? It's centenary. 100-year anniversary. You can go to IWW.org and you can see all about those folks that are still organizing. All right. Let's see here. Oh, yeah. 420 is the police code for possession, says Nick, who writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And here's another one. Bruce. Oh, I see. This is Bruce, the webmaster of... wait a minute. I'm losing it totally. Yes, it is. Never mind. We won't talk about it. Okay. Not that I ever did this, but I heard from a friend who heard from a friend that 420 is this. There are 420 active cannabinoids. There you go. Cannabinoids in marijuana. Yeah, it's the stuff that you get high from. And apparently there's six people in the TomHartman.com chat room listening to this show and commenting. They could use a lot more. TomHartman.com, go to the chat room, and we can use his chat room while this is all going on. But it turns out none of this is true. Or I don't know, maybe it is. If you always go to Snopes.com, S-N-O-P-E-S.com. 420 entered drug parlance is a term signifying the time to light up a joint. True. Can make it out. 420 began its sub rosa linguistic career in 1971 as a bit of slang casually used by a group of high school kids at San Rafael High School in California. 420, always pronounced 420, never 420. 420 came to be an accepted part of the argot within the group about a dozen pot smokers, beginning as a reminder of the time they plan to meet to light up 420. All right, so much for all that. It's more, but maybe I should go back to you, all right, because you are what makes the show happen. Here's Mike in Sterling Heights. Mike, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Good evening.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
I want to talk a little bit about the Downing Street memo.
Yes. Let me just interrupt. Do you realize that there are still, how do I know? But I'm willing to bet a minimum of 50% of the people, maybe 75% of the people listening, have no idea what the Downing Street memo is.
Of course not. I mean, what I wanted to talk about was this whole issue right now is completely untouchable and ignored by all the mainstream media. NBC, CBS, ABC... have completely ignored it. I have not seen anybody talk about it at all. A few newspapers have run stories on it,
mm-hmm.
And a couple of those have only done it after their readership became active enough and demanded that the paper actually do something about it. Now, personally, myself, I have emailed NBC Nightly News, Sam Donaldson. I've got a hold of Mr. Lair from PBS.
Well, wait a minute, Mike. Hold on. There are still people that are going, so what is it already?
Okay, the Downing Street memo is the minutes of a meeting that took place, I believe, in 2002 between some of the higher-level
Here, wait a minute. Wait a minute, Mike. I can read it for you. Be a lot easier than either of us. I see. I was trying to get you to do the heavy lifting here. Tim Russert said on Meet the Press, he said, there was a memo July 23rd, 2002, from the head of British intelligence to Prime Minister...
Right, from C.
Prime Minister Blair. In effect, notes taken from a briefing that was given to Blair after the head of British intelligence came back from a trip to Washington. It says this, the head of British intelligence reported on his recent trip, there was a... military action was now seen as inevitable. Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action justified by the conjunction of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, but the intelligence and the facts were being fixed around the policy.
Correct.
Yeah. So this is the smoking gun.
The smoking gun, as we know, our people, I can't remember the gentleman's name, but went back to Iraq, and they looked and looked and looked, and they found no weapons of mass destruction. And you can even tie Mr. Bolton into this.
Sure.
And Mr. Bolton wanted to fire, I believe it was a Spanish weapons or nuclear inspector who wanted to go there because he knew that if these guys went there, they would find the truth and that they were trying to actually, you know, cut that off before it could happen. This is basically a capital and treasonable offense by the current government.
Well, I mean, let's just call it impeachable offense. It is a high crime.
It's treason. This is the kind of thing that basically I think most Americans have read it just bury their heads in the sand about and talk about weed. I mean, don't get me wrong. I fire it up as much as anybody. But, I, when it comes to talking about what 420 means as opposed to the fact that we have a government now that is basically as Orwellian as it could get. The Ministry of Truth has become the Ministry of Lies.
Well, the Ministry of Truth, of course, in 1984 was the Ministry of Lies. But, think about what the country was sent through by the Republicans for what Clinton did. How little what he did actually affected policy. Think even in terms of Richard Nixon, that he was about to be impeached by the entire Congress, including the Republicans, for the misdeeds and criminal acts that he had committed. And all of them pale. I mean, certainly Clinton's do. But even Nixon's pale. I mean, he should have been impeached, Nixon. And he realized that's why he resigned. But those acts are little compared to what this Bush gang has done.
Peter, do you know that more was spent prosecuting Bill Clinton through the Star Chamber than was spent on the whole 9/11 commission?
Yeah, I do indeed. And how about this? Do you know that money is still being spent on this, what was it called, Whitewater investigation? What was it, up towards $60 or $70 million of our tax dollars in order to find out that, in fact, Bill and Hillary had done nothing illegal?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, the whole prosecution of Bill Clinton for getting a Beeger was little more than an attempt at coup d'etat using what Miss Lewinsky called a perjury trap. I mean, yeah, he lied about getting a little. But you know something? I know there's a lot of guys probably listening who have lied about getting a little.
Well, I'll tell you, on the other hand, most of our friends that lie a little aren't president of the United States. And I don't want to take it off of old Clinton that he allowed himself. I'll tell you, if I was Bill Clinton and all of a sudden some intern starts making goo-goo eyes at me, the first thing that would occur to me was, I can never do this and get away with it. I can never do this and get away with it. The second thing I would occur to me if I was Bill Clinton would be, this could be a Republican setup. I mean, I don't think it was, but I mean, it could have been. That's what I would think. And the fact that that he went ahead with this and allowed the Republicans to do what they what they eventually did and sent what chaos they sent the country into. I mean, sure, they're culpable in all this, but I don't want to take any of the blame for allowing that to occur off of Clinton. All right, thank you very much, Mike. Appreciate it. Downing Street Memo dot what? Hold on, you don't have to even call in or anything like that because I'm going to go to my website here, peterwerby.com. Boom. Okay. Let's see if I did it right. Yeah. So it's P-E-T-L. Man, what does that mean? Oh, because I spelled my damn name wrong. That's right. Okay. P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E. That's where you'll find that. And you can find the link. I want you to check that out. Okay, wait, one more little thing here. We'll hit enter. Okay, here it comes. And in fact, there's something I wanted to just see. I think it's the Downing Street, these damn links drive me nuts. And it's, okay, here it is, DowningStreetMemo.com. DowningStreetMemo.com. And if you're going, I don't even know if we still have successfully told everybody what this is. And if you're kind of foggy about all of this, this is history now. I mean, we began to find out that things like the Maine, the sinking of the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor in, what was it, 1898, wasn't it? 1898, I think. That was a rigged job, that the Spanish never did that. We found out that the sinking of the Lusitania, which was the excuse for going into World War I that the United States never should have entered, was based on a lie as well. We found that out 50 years later. Found out maybe 20, 25 years later that there never was the attack on American ships. Ships in the North China Sea, the Tonkin Bay, I guess it was. It was a Tonkin Bay incident. That was a whole lie as well. Well, right now we have found that the government of the United States has lied to us purposely in order to thrust us into a war for commercial purposes, the control of oil. This is blood for oil, and it's all over George W. Bush. Well, there's nothing we can do to Lyndon Johnson or to, Wilson. I can't think of his first name. President Woodrow, right? Woodrow Wilson or President McKinley in 1898. But there is something that we can do right now to George W. Bush. One thing. And that is the proper legal proceedings, which is called impeachment. And there's very, very few in Congress that have the stomach for this. Certainly the Democrats, which are not an opposition party. They're simply another party. And they're hoping that the weight of Bush's lies and crimes are just going to topple the whole edifice. And then they'll be able to get their part of the ruling racket in. Well, that's not enough for us. Or at least it shouldn't be. Now, the wonderful Congressman John Conyers of Detroit, is going to be holding hearings on the Downing Street memo, and that's coming up pretty soon. If anybody knows what that is or when that is, give me a shout at 313-298-WRIF. But you can go to his website as well. In fact, maybe I'll do that. JohnConyers.com, Conyers. All right, let's get some more of your calls on the air, and no name here, but welcome to the broadcast. Who's this?
Hello.
Hello, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, what's going on, Peter?
Who's this? I don't have a name up there.
Oh, Dan.
Hi, Dan, where are you calling from?
Forest, Ontario.
Well, you're on the air.
I hear that. Hey, man, about 420.
Yeah.
My understanding is Jerry Garcia died April the 20th at 420 in the morning.
Really?
That's what I understand.
Well, that's always a possibility.
I don't know, but that's what my buddy told me, and my dad gets high then, so.
Well, he probably gets high on other days as well.
I'm sure he does.
All right. Thanks for that. Thanks for making our show international. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling in from Canada. All right. And let's see. Some open lines, by the way. 313-298-WRIF. You know, we're not getting the volume of calls tonight, which is okay. I got a lot to say, and there's enough people up here. But the number of people supporting Bush and the war has dropped so significantly that I don't think the opposition's out there. I mean, what can somebody say? All right, here's Pamela in Waterford. Pamela, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I have an aspect that people aren't thinking of about the medical use of marijuana.
Sure.
How about mental health people? I'm one of them. I'm 37 years old. I've been smoking since I was like 12.
Uh-huh.
In all the therapies I've been in, they've never said it's substance abuse. They always say, you've been self-medicating yourself all these years. They never say it's bad. I would much rather be smoking one than to be hooked on Prozacs and Somas and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And not to mention, that stuff's costly to be given to me more than marijuana.
Sure.
Not to mention medication, after a while like that, it hurts your liver. Eventually it starts hurting your liver. Marijuana doesn't do that.
Well, yeah, let me just tell people that are ringing in now. Jay Hudson, our producer and phone screener, is answering calls, and he's going to get to you. So if you're ringing, just keep on ringing. Well, you know, Pamela, I think that's a very interesting concept about self-medication, because as I've said on other occasions, I have known people in every profession, unfortunately doctors, but police officers, prosecutors, defense attorneys, people in the arts and everything under the sun that as adults smoke marijuana regularly, and they don't appear high in the slightest. They go into court with and argue briefs in front of judges stoned out of their brains. And for all I know, maybe the judge is stoned too and self-medicating, right?
Yes. Wouldn't you much rather have someone that's just smoking one driving down the road or whether, as opposed to someone doing 2-3 somas a day, a bunch of Xanax? I mean, I'd much rather be just smoking one.
Yeah,
I don't want to be all funny and on the road not acting right. When you're smoking one, you're still yourself.
Well,
I don't know about
smoking and driving. Now you're getting into a dangerous...
How many accidents are there because somebody was smoking pot?
I don't know.
There isn't. It's always the drunk driver or the pill head or the coke head.
No, that's never true.
The pot head.
All right. But still, I think the laws that say no intoxication while driving are good ones. Pamela, thanks for calling in. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hey, Tigers fans, this summer, why sit at home when you could sit at home? Late, that is. Now is a great time to catch all the fun and excitement happening at every Detroit Tigers home game. You'll see plenty of homers by Pudge Rodriguez, Dimitri Young, Carlos Guillen, and all your favorite players. But a trip to Comerica Park means more than just baseball. While the Tigers are driving home runs, you could drive home in a brand new car during the Chevy Cobalt Drive One Home Giveaway, sponsored by your Detroit area Chevy dealers. Just buy a ticket to select Friday or Saturday night home games, and you could drive one out of here. Looking for a surefire hit? Hey, don't miss Friday and Saturday night fireworks sponsored by Pepsi and Verizon Wireless. And with a weekend value pack, that's 4 tickets, 4 hot dogs, and 4 Pepsis for just $59. And you'll want to bring everyone from home. So for great giveaways like autographed balls, bobbleheads, collector cards, and jerseys, and for great baseball, this summer, catch a Tigers game. For tickets, call 248-25-TIGER or visit DetroitTigers.com and make Comerica Park your home away from home game.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for big money. The OSI Pro Series WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Championship Series is underway, and there's still time to enter to win the $1,500 Series Championship. Sign up now for the Bass Championship going out of Lake Erie Metro Park on July 30th. Slots will fill up fast, so get your entry in now. Compete for thousands of dollars in cash and prizes, including the DMF Bait Award for the kid under 16 landing the largest fish on live bait. It's all going to be given away to the best fishing team in town, so sign up now by calling 248-591-6841 or go to WRIF.com for an entry form. There will be fun for everyone at the post-event party at Big Al Sports Grill, so call 248-591-6841 to become the OSI Pro Series WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. Brought to you by OSI Pro Series, the DMF Bait Company, Big Al Sports Grill, and 101 WRIF.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Detroit's rock station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Walker's Speakeasy, the West Side's hottest destination for great food, drinks, and daily entertainment. Located on Beach Daily in Dearborn Heights. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to wrif.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at wrif.com.
This is WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. At 1 a.m., we're going to be playing an interview with Ethan Nadelman, who is executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, about the Supreme Court decision. Also, syndicated columnist Norman Solomon, who is in Iran right now, but is talking about the Downing Street memo. If you want to think about this stuff, I mean, I assume since you're listening to this broadcast, you care about these issues. So know fully. And there, Steve in Lincoln Park wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, said that there is a new Downing Street memo, and it's from the Times of London, which I'm pretty sure is a conservative paper and did not back Tony Blair. But you can go to my website, peterwerby.com, peterwerbe.com, and get information about the new one. Also, James listening in Kenosha, Wisconsin, he said there's another website regarding the Downing Street memo. What did I say it was? Downingstreetmemo.com. There's one called afterdowningstreet.org. afterdowningstreet.org. That also is on my website, peterwerby.com as well. Let's see, I thought there was one more about this. I guess not. But remember after, I never understood this. I mean, it was very, very startlingly depressing when George W. Bush was, how can we say it? He really wasn't reelected because he really wasn't elected the first time. They stole that one. They really stole the second one as well, particularly with what happened in Ohio, with denying African Americans the ability to vote and the controlling the voting machines and what have you. So my view is that Bush and the Republicans stole two elections in a row. You know, Howard Dean's been getting a lot of criticism, that's the word, right? Howard Dean's been getting a lot of criticism because he said, what was his quote? He said that the Republicans are not very friendly to different kinds of people. They're a pretty monolithic party. It's pretty much a white Christian party. So all these Republicans are just going bonkers, and all these right-wing pundits on the air saying, oh, you know how terrible he is. And I was reading in MakeThemAccountable.com, MakeThemAccountable.com, Carolyn Kay's wonderful website. She said the objective part of Dean's statement was factual. 82% of Republicans identify themselves as white Christians. Yeah, that's it. Which, by any reasonable definition, makes the grand old party, the GOP, a pretty monolithic party. Insofar as whether Republicans are, quote, not friendly to different kinds of people, the website says, that is admittedly a subjective judgment which depends on whether one considers it friendly to intimidate African Americans from voting and to preventing gays from getting married. In fact, the Pope has weighed in. See where he's going with all this. He has said, Pope Benedict, in his first clear pronouncement on gay marriages since his election, condemned same-sex unions as fake and expressions of, quote, anarchic freedom. Two of my favorite words, anarchic freedom. And he says they threaten the future of the family. The Pope, who was elected in April, also condemned divorce. I mean, it's not a good thing to happen. I mean, you know, all of us, many of us have been divorced. Not me, but many of us, many of my friends, many of your friends. So it's not good, but condemning it. So, I mean, he doesn't want it to happen. You stick with him or her regardless. Then also, he doesn't want artificial birth control. So, no condoms or anything like that. Doesn't want any trial marriages. Just get married, right? And then freestyle unions. He doesn't say what that is, but hey, that sounds like the 60s. He said, all these practices are dangerous for the family. Today's various forms of dissolution of marriage, free unions, trial marriages, as well as pseudo-matrimonies between people of the same sex are instead expressions of anarchic freedom, which falsely tries to pass itself off as the true liberation of man. And man, that's like 1950s talk. But maybe he's just concerned with the liberation of men. Well, I mean, how can this guy, I mean, doesn't he have any sense of propriety? I mean, the Catholic Church has paid out over $1 billion settling lawsuits for sexual abuse by its employees, priests, right? And is expected to rise because there's hundreds of claims still pending against the church. And he is lecturing us on things like divorce and gay marriage and what have you. Now, two things. One, these guys never, whether it's religious people that want to intervene in everyone's life or just these conservatives that are always talking about this is going to threaten the family, or it threatens the family. It's dangerous to the family. They never say how. They never say how this is going to happen, or what's going to happen, or how destructive is gay marriage, or what is this other stuff he's talking about. I mean, he says artificial birth control is dangerous to the family. Why are these people highly respected? I don't understand this. They come from this totally corrupt institution. I mean, that is rift with sexual scandal, and they quote him uncritically. This is Pope Benedict I'm talking about. So let me ask you this. Anybody have an idea how a gay marriage threatens or does anything to a family? I mean, I'm married to a woman. I mean, these people piss me off so much. If I ever get married, I'm going to marry a guy. Just so I can say, I can't say that. Yeah, just throw it up in their face. So, in fact, I said that another time when some guy proposed to me. I'm still thinking about it. Send a picture next time. So that doesn't make any sense. Well, there was another thing. Oh, yeah, anarchic freedom. Anarchic freedom. I really like that concept. First off, these folks don't like freedom, and they're fearful of freedom. I mean, they're authoritarians. They like these patriarchal top-down religions, and that's why they would like their politics as well. Authoritarian. In fact, totalitarian, if you think about it. You know, the Catholic Church considered itself, after the unification of Italy, when the hell was that, 1860s, 1880s, or something like that, there were these little principalities, and there was the papal area. What's that called? Okay, it's getting too late. Anyway, the Pope considered himself a prisoner in the Vatican up until what leader gained the power in Italy? You guessed it, Mussolini. So these folks don't, I mean, you know, I'm not trying to say that they're fascists or, I mean, some of them, what was that, the John the 23rd or something like that. He was trying to make something decent out of the church. And, of course, all these conservatives grabbed the power and turned it back to, something like the Middle Ages or whatever. But, wait a minute, anarchic freedom. Anarchy means self-regulation. I mean, it's used as a synonym for chaos. But if you go to the strict definition of anarchy, for one thing, it's the way all native people live. They don't have governments. They don't have rulers or anything like that. We invented that with civilization. In fact, go to infoshop.org, and they have frequently asked questions, FAQs, right? And that'll tell you about the philosophy and the political system, if you will. I don't think it's fair to call it a system, but a political system of anarchy. Anarchic freedom, to me, means the ability to live one's life freely without the intervention of the political state, as long as you're not hurting anybody. And nobody came up with that, I think, pagan quote about do what thy will, but hurt no one. It's something like that. And that's what's really important. All right, there's a lot of people that are waiting in their in distant states, and we don't have an 800 number here, so let me get to them. Here's Bruce in North Carolina. Bruce, thanks for being so patient and for calling from so far away. You're on the air. Go ahead. Am I doing something wrong, or did Bruce figure that he wasn't going to pay the tab after all? Let me see. That's up. That's on. No. There you go. Bruce, hi. You're on the air. Sorry.
Okay. You're touching a lot of topics there, but I think the one thing that sort of stood out for me was, you know, the fact that the current regime really does not respect freedom. Freedom is a buzzword for this current administration.
Sure.
You listen to speeches, and they will say evil and freedom and other, you know, homeland and fatherland. Oh, I didn't mean to say that. You know, in all these speeches, but, you know, when the push comes to shove, there's freedom-limiting activities that go on, such as James Sensenbrenner did on Friday when he shut down the Patriot Act reauthorization hearing.
Yeah, right. That was pretty weird.
That was appalling. I rewatched that this afternoon, and it just blew me away as to, how quickly the tide has turned. But keep up the great work and keep pushing the Downing Street memo because, today the AP ran the story early this morning and it went out to probably 40 newspapers. By 2 o'clock this afternoon, it had disappeared.
Really?
Yes.
Well, someone wrote me. I was just kind of looking for it right now. John Conyers of Michigan, representing the Detroit area, is going to be holding hearings beginning this Thursday. Someone just wrote me in, and I seem to have lost who it was. And those are going to be, semi-official hearings. I mean, the Congress isn't approving him, but he's going to be taking testimony. And hopefully that when the Downing Street memo, what can we compare it to? What other document in... There seems to me there's other documents in American history that have just blown apart. I'll tell you, it's like the Pentagon Papers did for the Vietnam War, really exposed the lies of the Nixon and the Johnson administrations.
Well, I think it's interesting also that there are bits and pieces of this coming out weekly.
Yeah, we'll see. All right, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks again for calling in from North Carolina. Here is Ben calling from Illinois. Ben, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hi there, Ben from WhiteRoseSociety.org here.
Ben, well, thank you so much. Let me. Ben is one of the people that I and so many other progressive and talk show hosts on the left owe such a debt of gratitude to, because Ben and WhiteRoseSociety.org archives all of our shows. So, welcome.
Thank you. In addition to your show, I mean, there are well over a dozen others on the average weekday. I archive 30-plus hours of talk, and so you could be listening to progressive talk 24/7 and not hear anything repeated.
Now, are you hearing our show? I just got an email from Shelby, who streams our show through radiopower.org, and she said there was technical problems on her end, but she said now we're streaming live through radiopower.org.
Yeah, I've had a stream constantly, so I'm at an issue here.
Maybe it was on her end.
Sometimes the internet gets weird, and the connections in between one place and another get bad for a period of time.
Okay, what's on your mind tonight, Ben?
Okay, two things. One is I can answer the 420 question.
Okay.
This is something that that Normal figured out long ago, what the origin of this story was. And by the way, if you're a pot smoker, or if you support the rights of people to smoke marijuana or to have marijuana as a medical drug, or even the right to grow non-drug-bearing hemp for industrial uses, which would be a really marvelous application for some of our lesser-producing farmland, you should give some money to Normal, NORML.org.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, the 420, this started with a group of high school students in California. I forget exactly which city now. One day they were all going to get together and get high after school. And, school ended about 4, and so they were going to meet by a particular statue in the park at 420.
Okay, well.
And then the next day they decided to do it again. And then eventually they said, what time is 420? Because, they had to move the time around, the place around.
Yeah.
Where is 420? What time is 420? And this sort of spread out to their friends and their friends' friends, and eventually people forgot where it came from, but that is the origin of it. It's not a police code.
Well, I actually looked in, did you send me that, Snopes.com?
No, someone else must have done that.
Okay. Actually, it was... someone with the same last name as yours, but their first name was Bruce, and it kind of threw me.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
There are not a lot of us Birches.
Yes. Wait a minute. Now, that's okay. So Snopes.com said that what you just related, that occurred in San Rafael, California, 1971. So that's 34 years ago, right?
Right.
I never heard of 420. Now, I've known some people that have smoked marijuana. And, I mean, I said earlier about all these people I knew. And I have to admit, Ben, are you ready for this? I mean, I know this goes into the archives at WhiteRoseSociety.org and all this, so I'm really choosing my words carefully. But in college, I experimented with marijuana.
Well, you went to college. I mean, doesn't everyone who goes to college do that?
Well, I mean, can I say about the experiment? It was
sure.
A success!
Yes!
All right. Thank you.
my similar experiments at the University of Chicago were also a success. And, of course, we had to repeat them with double-blind studies. Just to be sure, because in the University of Chicago, we were very careful about these things. The other thing is... Dean was absolutely positively right, and I'll extend his comments. It is not only a white Christian party, it is the white Christian power party.
Sure.
The only reason a female or a person of color is ever brought into the Republican Party is either window dressing or to clean up after the elephant.
All right, thanks, Ben.
Okay, one more thing.
Yeah.
The quote you were looking for is... And it harm none, do what thou wilt.
Okay. And is that pagan?
That's the pagan version. And there's a Thelemite version, which is do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thanks for all your effort on behalf of this show and so many others. All right. That's WhiteRoseSociety.org. Yeah. Let's go to Ann Arbor, and it's Ann. Hi, Ann. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Am I doing something wrong again? Yeah. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hey, Ann.
Hi.
Hi, it was my fault. Sorry.
Yep, that's okay. I just wanted to say that actually, and especially this is really good, considering the young man's last comment, I'm actually a woman, and I am a Republican, and I live in a ragingly liberal, and...
Wait, you know, your phone cut out there for a minute. You said you're a woman, and what?
I am a Republican, and I do live in Ann Arbor, and I know you said that the elections were stolen, which I don't agree with, but I just wanted to say that as you are entitled to your opinion, so am I.
Sure.
And I did vote for Bush, and I do feel that I'm not saying he's perfect. In fact, there's several things I don't agree with him on, but between the two parties, yeah, the other one scared the hell out of me. So there's got to be a little bit of morality left somewhere in this country, because I fully feel that that is the downfall of our country right now.
Well, Ann, you can't believe that these people that get caught in scandal after scandal after scandal in the Republican Party on sexual and financial matters represents the high moral ground.
Well, no, but if you remember correctly, your President Clinton was actually the only president to actually be impeached. So, and that was also due to a moral issue, which came down to the fact that he lied under oath.
Wait a minute. There was Andrew Johnson who was impeached. Actually, remember that? And also that Nixon quit just ahead. I mean, here is a fine pillar of morality.
Mm-hmm.
He quit ahead of impeachment because he knew that he was going to, A, be impeached by, and including Republicans would have joined in it. And you say, you're President Clinton. Well, I'll let you in on a dirty little secret, Ann. I never voted for him either time. In fact, the only time I ever voted for a Democrat in my life was for John Kerry. And I thought he was a terrible candidate. But, you know, I belonged to the, what was it, anybody but Bush crew. Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that you have some criticisms of Bush, because usually Democrats and liberals and leftists and progressives and everybody on the left of the spectrum always is very, very critical of the Democrats. And yet, when I ask Republicans, I say, what? Do you think Bush ever done anything wrong? And they usually don't come up with a single thing. So what's your criticism of it?
Oh, sure. But I also think, too, though, that I also think that that kind of works both ways. Because a lot of times I've tried to have discussions with friends of mine who are very strong liberals, and I appreciate the fact that they're entitled to that. And we try to have discussions, and sometimes it works both ways because they can see nothing wrong with the way that they think. So it's very frustrating, but I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that we're all humans.
All right. Well, you're starting to cut out again. So, as they used to say in the 50s, I'm going to cut out. Thanks for joining us, Ann. I appreciate it. Thanks for having been so patient and waiting as well. You know, I started one conversation. I know you can't believe this because I'm always so coherent, aren't I? Anyways, I started to say that after the election, that's right, because that's what Ann was answering when I was saying that both elections, 2004, were stolen by the Republicans. Anyway, after the 2004 election, most of my friends were despondent upon belief. I mean, they were going to Canada, they were going to go to Australia, they're going to move to Europe, anywhere to get out of what they call Jesus land or dumb, I got to make sure I don't say this, dumb Ephistan, you know, everything that the that all these maps would showed. Anyway, but be that what it may, and I kept saying, look, even if Bush didn't steal the election in Ohio, and hence giving him the presidency for two times running, he got 50.8%. Even with Kerry being such a weak and equivocal candidate, even with the media playing up every one of his worst aspects and never giving the—I mean, in other words, it was there was no Democratic media, even from the Democratic Party media, even from the ones that endorsed him, as far as I'm concerned, that Bush only could garner 50.8%. Now, 52% says the U.S. has not become safer because of the Iraq War, but even more so, nearly three quarters of us say the numbers of casualties in Iraq is unacceptable. And then when you say three quarters, you know, I always say like a third of the country are just these kind of out and out fascists that are the some of the people you can fool all the time because they want to be fooled because they love power. They're just dupes for the wealthy, and I don't know what the hell they get out of it. I mean, you know, I think it's like kind of these fearful personalities filled with anger. You know, they're fearful of their own rage, yet they want some outlet for it, so they really love wars and all that. But when they start going bad, so this is dipped even into the fascist right. Three quarters of us say the number of casualties in Iraq is unacceptable. It's now over 1,700 and climbing. Two-thirds of us say the U.S. military is bogged down in Iraq, and 60% say the war was not worth fighting. The war was not, 60%. So, hey, we are in the majority. So why is this war still going on? Why isn't there a vast anti-war movement that does something every day? Why aren't members of the so-called opposition party, the Democrats, why aren't they making this central issue? People are getting ground up in this terrible meat grinder, killing and being killed on all sides. And, of course, what it gets down to when you're there is staying alive, right? Or inflicting as much damage on the people that you see as your enemy. You can fit in the names either way. According to this Washington Post article, perhaps most ominous for Bush, 52% of the war in Iraq has not contributed to the long-run security of the United States. I would say it's made us less secure. It was the first time a majority of Americans disagreed with the central notion Bush had offered to build support for the war. And 52% now disapprove of how Bush is handling his job, the highest of his presidency. A somewhat larger majority, 56%, disapproved of Republicans in Congress as well. Good. He deserves it. You can fool all the people some of the time. We got fooled. I mean, I don't know. I didn't. A lot of you listening here didn't. We knew he was lying right from the beginning. We knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. We knew it was blood for oil, didn't we? All right, let's continue on. Here is Distery in Westland. Am I saying your name correctly? Hi. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. This is Distery from Taylor.
Hi, Distery. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing all right.
Good.
I wanted to comment on the 420 question. The
sure.
guy from White Rose had it completely correct. It is a term that came from high school students that is now referred to as the pretty much international time to smoke weed.
Boy, when did you start hearing about this?
Oh, I've known about it for about as long as I've smoked weed as my parents did and my friends did and everybody that I've pretty much known has.
Wow.
And even High Times, if you go to High Times, they've done a story in one of their magazines about it.
You know,
I think what?
You know what this means, Destry? I'm a square from Squaresville.
Square.
I'm a square
no,
from
no.
Squaresville.
I just might need to smoke a little more. That always helps a little. But, yeah, I completely agree with that one lady that called, too. I think that the government is making too much of a big deal about it. They need to be cracking down more so on the alcohol, look how many kids it's killing. And
sure.
I mean, I've never heard of anybody ever in my life getting hurt from smoking weed. And, I mean, the only thing that I could really see that it would make a difference in if they legalized it, it would eliminate the drug dealers and all the real bad drugs that are so prevalent and available to all these children that are just trying to smoke a little weed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really wondered what happened to PRA. I mean, there was a movement a couple years back that was a petition to to legalize it. And I signed the petition, and I just kept waiting for it to come to ballot, and I never heard anything else about it.
Well, I did not make it onto the ballot, and I think these forces from time to time, they rise and they fall. But I think now with the Supreme Court decision, which, if you're up for a while, like at 1 a.m., I'm going to be playing this interview with Ethan Nadelson from the Drug Policy Alliance, and I think he reads it that this decision is actually more positive than negative, the Supreme Court decision. Because essentially, Associate Justice John Paul Stevens lectured Congress, said, hey, make some changes here. All right, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thanks for calling in. And let's see, are y'all in the same house? Here is James from Westland as well. James, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete.
Hi.
I called last week and I emailed you about the Jack Thompson thing.
We're going to try this again? Yeah.
Well, I just want to mention it real quick. I have another point. But I've left out of the email that his website, stopkill.com, it's more pro him and mentions more
wait a minute, James.
Jargon.
Nobody knows what in the hell we're even talking
okay,
about. Just tell me. It's
Jack Thompson.
Wait. No. It's too complicated. It's
okay.
stopkill.com?
Yes.
Okay. People can go there. What's your other point?
I wanted to bring up a little bit about the Downing Street memo again.
The Downing Street memo, right.
Right. I've been saying to a lot of my friends that what the Downing Street memo has said.
Yeah.
That's the proof that we need to get him out of office, get Bush out of office.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to happen, and I've been saying for years that he's been lying to us. And they didn't believe me.
Here's the proof. But there's got to be one of two things, James. There either has to be what one would think, like what happened around the Watergate scandal with Richard Nixon when it came out that all the crimes that his administration had perpetrated, that the politicians that are whose duties are defined under the Constitution would function properly. And they began proceedings against Nixon. That's not happening here. And I, even though John Conyers from Detroit is going to begin hearings on Thursday, but I suspect that through the Congress, little will come of it. I may be wrong. I mean, I would hope to be wrong. The other thing is, what we're missing in times like this, as I say repeatedly, is the people in motion. Democracy, popular democracy. Look in Bolivia. I mean, they've driven, at least two, maybe even three presidents out of office and objected to the chain of succession. So now they have somebody in there that was the head of the Supreme Court of Bolivia. You can say, well, wait a minute, that's not very democratic or legal or whatever. Well, what's going on in the inner circles of government isn't very legal or constitutional or what have you. So what we need is either an opposition party, which I don't think exists, or the people in motion that creates history, like we always have, from the beginnings of our revolution to every monumental change. The only role politicians have ever played in that change is to run ahead of the people in motion. All right, James, thank you. Appreciate it. We'll be right back.
This is WRIM.com.
Harley Davidson Harley Fest 2005, presented by 101 WRIM, Moulton, and Jerome Duncan Ford. Your chance to nab a 2005 Harley Davidson Custom XL 883 Sportster.
Yeah!
Stand, park it in the driveway next to a sweet new Ford Harley Davidson F-250 truck, and a glove box stuffed with $5,000 in gold, hard cash.
Compliments of Rock Financial.
Just keep your radio locked on 101 The Rift to win a key, along with tickets to see Tesla Friday, June 17th. Also, listen for details on Harley Bike Nights around the Motor City, where you can grab a key in person. Harley Fest 2005, presented by Motor City Harley Davidson.
Feel the freedom at the number one dealer, located in Farmington Hills.
Molson,
making friends since 1786.
Jerome Duncan Ford,
Michigan's number one Ford dealer.
Security provided by Gallagher Security, trained professionals for crowd safety and management.
101 WRIF.
Riff Rock.
Bill Bonds with a commercial. If you're near or farsighted and you want to throw away those glasses forever, I know a doctor you should see. Dr. Escombati. Phone number 1-877. Then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 1-877-UC-MORE. The equipment, the finest high-tech equipment ever made. Price $999 per eye. So don't fall for those $200 prices you hear being tossed around on the radio. Cows don't fly. Neither do those prices, unless your daddy is an eye doctor and you're getting a freebie. Dr. S. Combati, no doctor we know of has a better success rate. Procedure is fast, safe, cost $999 per eye. Virtually painless, you're in and out, maybe 40 minutes. Procedure itself, maybe 5. When it's over, you'll want to kiss your glasses goodbye and hug the doctor. Or maybe you guys will just want to give him a hi-fi, shake hands with him, walk away, and see a whole new world. See ya.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Riff rocks the road. Every week, check out WRIF.com for information on upcoming Riff events. Sponsored by Wireless Toys. Announcing no more activation fees. Get reimbursed for the activation fee on any new service, any new provider.
Riff rocks.
Listening to WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our last segment for this evening, at least our phone-in talk show, because at 1 a.m. we're going to have a couple of interviews that I recorded previously, one of them with Ethan Nadelson, who is the head of the Drug Policy Alliance. We're going to be talking about the Supreme Court decision about medical marijuana. And then Norman Solomon is going to be talking about this Downing Street memo that we were mentioning. And if you're still saying, what is this? Stay tuned for this. Norman Solomon is a syndicated columnist, a journalist. He's in Iran right now to cover the elections that are occurring. And we'll have an interview with him when we come back. I was looking for that little piece that I read about the Pope, who was, condemning gay marriages as anarchic freedom and all this other stuff. And I just got this results of this Associated Press poll about how important religion is in the life of Americans. Now, all of a sudden I lost this. Oh, yeah. Nearly all U.S. respondents said the faith was important to them, and only 2% said they did not believe in God. Huh. Nearly all U.S. respondents said faith was important to them, and only 2% said they did not believe in God. Do I know them all? Do I know every single person? How could that be? I can't believe this. Pardon me. 40% of the people said religious leaders should try to sway policymakers, notably higher than other countries. And yeah, nobody else is like this. But in this study from the City University of New York, it says American Religious Identification Study 2001 concludes that 14% of Americans have no religion. Also, that there is a huge number of pagans in the United States. So that's a little better. But still, you know, I just don't think, I'm sometimes surprised when people that, particularly that I work with, not that I know with, because everybody I know is, that's not true. Like, I'm trying to go through all my close friends. All my close friends, I would say, are atheists. Aren't I? Am I correct? Yeah, I think so. I don't know. But in any event. There's a lot of people I know and respect that are religious, Christians, Jews, Muslims, as a matter of fact, Buddhists, and so I know a great number of people that consider themselves theists. But I think this is lip service to polls. They say that faith is very important to them. I mean, I know a lot of people. I mean, the people I know that are religious liberals, and their faith is very important to them. They act off of their personal desire for peace and social justice out of a religious context. So I'm actually putting together a page in my website. I can't remember what it is, but something about not believing in God. But if I did, I'd be just like these people. So I've got on one side of it, I'm going to have all the just hideous stuff that these right wing, and that's the key. Although, yeah, I don't know. It's a long discussion. Kind of mixed. But anyways, if I was going to be religious, I would be like these people. I'd have, you know, all of them and list of them, you know, like Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. or Gandhi or who else? There's got to be some others, right? But then when you, if you look, for instance, at the publication that comes out of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, you can go to their initial, FFR, what is it? Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org, and they've got like 2 pages in every issue of their newspaper, Free Thought Today, that lists the legal crimes that religious clergy are being prosecuted for. Not just people that are religious, but the clergy. They call it black-collar crime. You know, they call white-collar crime black-collar crime. So, never mind. I don't even know where I'm going with this. But stuff like that's always hard for me to really figure out. I mean, maybe I just know everybody that that's an atheist. Here is Jay. He's been waiting an incredible long time. Jay, thanks for being so patient and joining us. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Peter.
Hi.
Yeah, I've listened to you for a fairly decent amount of time. I've never really gotten as mad as I got in the last few minutes.
Really? How come?
Yeah. Because I'm a very devout Catholic, and everything you said is just not true. I mean, it's true that that there are Catholic priests in America, that have been committing sexual felonies and whatnot. But if you look overseas, everywhere in the world except for here, the Catholic Church is doing wonderful things for millions and millions of people. And you
like what?
It's not helping.
Well, name a few. What? What are they doing?
They're providing assistance that does not necessarily require abortion. They're helping people to find adoptions in America and all over. In Africa, they're helping with abstinence and other such programs in Africa
With abstinence, what they need are condoms, man. They don't need no one's going to take part in abstinence programs. Are always failure. Look, the church does do some charitable work across the world, maybe even a lot of it.
More than any other anything in the entire world.
Well, I wouldn't say that's true. I would say in the third world country, probably Pentecostals is doing more than Catholics, but whatever.
Peter, that's ridiculous, and you know it.
Wait a minute. Why are you so quick to dismiss this? Do you know anything about Pentecostal activity in Latin America, in Africa, for instance? The answer is no, right?
No. But the reason I know a little about it is because I'm only 13 years old, and I already know it, that you're wrong.
Listen, what do you know about the Pentecostal churches in Brazil? Do you know anything about that? Of course you don't.
Right. There's probably about three of them.
Well, I'll tell you, my friend, Pentecostal is enormous in Latin America, and to the point where the church has conferences about how to meet the challenge of Pentecostalism. Also, you know, up until about 2 or 3 years ago, if someone would have said, do you think that the church is involved in any sexual abuse? Everyone would have said, no, of course not. So the fact that this hasn't come out, and it has come out in other countries, by the way, but not to this degree.
Exactly. The problem is not the Catholic Church in itself.
It's just the people that are part of it.
They're imperfect people and God's perfect vessel.
Well, whatever. All right, thank you. Appreciate it. Don't get so mad. Let's see, where do we want to go here? Let's go out to our friend in New Mexico. It's Roy calling in from Placitas, right?
Hey, good evening, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Shows how things have changed since my time. See, I was about 18 before I knew everything. He had to wait till he was about 16. Now it's down to 13?
13, yeah.
Oh, my. But that's okay. At least he's got some passion. That's better than some of these people.
Yeah. By the way, if someone wanted to check out the role of the Pentecostals in Latin America and in Africa, they should go to an article that I've mentioned several times. The author is Mike Davis. I would say read anything by Mike Davis: City of Quartz, Dead Cities, stuff like that. But also read his essay called Planet of Slums. All you have to do is just type in Planet of Slums into a search engine, Mike Davis, and that will come up. Go ahead.
Okey-doke. The lady that called, 20 minutes ago, the Republican, it was not, just kind of a lukewarm Bush supporter or something. And then she mentioned morality, and by the time she got the last syllable out, I was dialing in, because that had become my new buzzword. Everything that I've been doing since the day after the election, when I heard this crap about the polls saying morality was so important, I've been framing everything morality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd like to ask her, where's the morality in having a policy that allows prompts abortions to rise, be up 25%? Where is the morality of having 45 million people uninsured? Where's the morality in the illegal, immoral war?
Well, you're in a loop there, Roy. Actually, look at the individuals, though, who are putting this out. I don't know why anybody doesn't tally this up. If you look at the number of politicians that are caught with involved in financial and sexual and other kind of personal scandals, the Republicans outnumber the Democrats 10-1.
Yeah.
Easily. I mean, all these preachers that are always getting caught with prostitutes and just running these, scams, getting money from their parishioners and all that, they are 10-1 Republicans.
Where's the morality in Pat Robertson sitting on $500 million?
That's how much money he's got?
Oh, at least. He sold his TV station syndicate for $1 billion 10 years ago. So he lost some when he was trying to scam the diamond guy. But anyway.
Well, they're hypocrites beyond belief.
That one of the problems with the right-wing fundies is they have captured, everybody uses the term Christians and thinks of them. You know, they've kind of got it right there. It's kind of like we use the term Christian so many times when they're talking about the fundies.
The fundamentalists, yeah.
Christianity is like cars. There's everything from broken down junk Pintos to Rolls Royces. And Robertson and his bunch are junk
Pintos. Yeah. And I would say that the good religious folk that I know that are the backbone of the peace and social justice movement in this city, in the Detroit area, probably are at least the Cadillacs. Roy, I got to move on. Thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Thanks for calling in from so far away in New Mexico. Roy used to come visit us when I would broadcast live from Santa Fe. Here's Roger in Fenton, Michigan. Roger, hi. It's Peter Werby.
Hey, Peter. How you doing tonight, buddy?
Doing good. Thanks.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, the weapons of mass deception. You know, I just seen something in the paper, you know. I mean, my job's down right now, and there's all these people without a health care. But guess where the tax cuts just got us? More millionaires than ever.
Yeah, that's right.
As in a paper. That just amazes me, you know, that you know, here we're making more millionaires than ever. And what my second question was, what's going on with MoveOn.org? I guess they gave a congressman a bunch of signatures to get rid of that felon in Texas.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, it's, they had 50,000 signatures. You know, they got them for, charged them down there in Texas.
Did they? Are you sure? Are you sure they actually finally? No, I don't think they charged them.
Well, they said they found them guilty of $1.5 million of illegal contributions. That's what I've heard on the radio, and supposedly MoveOn.org collected a bunch of signatures and gave it to a congressman in Farmington Hills, but I didn't get the name.
Huh.
That's why I was just curious if you heard anything.
No, I think there's maybe some confusion here, but maybe someone in the final minutes remaining can remind it. Well, I'll tell you, Roger, the thing that still always perplexes me, when I see average middle class or working class people still supporting Bush without understanding what a danger he is to the fingernail grip so many Americans have on a middle class lifestyle and how threatening he is to all of that. All right, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. I'm getting towards the end of the show, so I'm going to have to move along quickly. Here's Al in Inkster. Al, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
It's not really a fingernail grip. I'm sliding farther and farther down the scale. You know, it's the kind of situation where he allows you to start with nothing and keep all of it at the end of the race.
Okay.
You know, one quick comment on 420. I used to have a bumper sticker on my old Hilo that said 419. You got a minute?
Really? So I am a square from Squaresville. I've never heard this till I actually heard some kind of straight liberal talk show host mentioning that, like he had discovered it too. Maybe all the vipers, as they used to call marijuana smokers, have finally said, "All right, we're going to let the squares in on this." So
yeah,
they got me.
It's been around since the late '80s. That's when I learned it. So.
Well, apparently it originated in the early
'70s.
Yep. Yep. All right. Go ahead. You got.
I want one last topic. I just want to talk about, you know, you mentioned morality, you know. This guy is not moral. He is totally immoral.
You must be talking about George W. Bush.
The fellatio artist in charge.
All right, we're going to let you go with that one, Al. Let's see here. Dave from St. Clair Shores. Dave, it's Peter Werby. You're our last caller. Go ahead.
Hey, I noticed not too long ago you were talking about the whole Catholic priest thing.
Yeah.
And actually, a few months back, I seen a thing on, I think, Court TV talking about that. There was a guy, he came over from, I think, Poland.
Uh-huh.
He became a Catholic priest, actually here in the Michigan area, claimed he was a victim of the Nazi thing.
Yeah.
And it turned out they found out that the guy was actually a Nazi leader.
Oh my God! Well, there
it's
is
kind of interesting.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. It just it's all, well, let me tell you this. There, I should have brought this along because the real crisis, what's going on here, is there is so little confidence in the major institutions of this society. I forgot why I decided not to bring it. But, you look at everything from Congress to the presidency to banks and HMOs. They said people that have high regard for HMOs. Gee, can you imagine how high that was? 8%. I'm wondering, who are these 8%? Maybe the people that own them, like Bill Frist, the head of the Republicans. So we've got, by the way, thank you so much. I appreciate you calling and being our last caller, Dave. We've got a major problem in this society. When the institutions that are at the core of social and economic and political life are under suspicion by most of us, and that's the way the stats read, we're in a society that has lost its dynamic quality to it. And I had a whole thing I wanted to talk about where we're going with military spending. But that then, what has become the rationale for the existence of this country is military might. Now, maybe that is something we should save for next week. We'll do that. All right. Stay tuned because I'm going to air this interview I did about the Supreme Court medical marijuana decision. In the meantime, take a look at my website, peterwerby.com, PETERWERBE.com. I'm selling nothing. Nothing accrues to me whatsoever by you going to it. But one of the things it does, if you're at all interested in examining these questions that we take up here just for 2-3 hours on a Sunday night, it has links that allow you to do this on a regular basis. And if you don't agree with the thing I'm saying, it's an interesting trip because this confronts you. Because I look at right-wing sites, and they say everything I'm saying is absolutely wrong. And I have to do that process of reexamining, how would I answer this if this person was sitting across a table from me? Well, it's 420, folks, so I'm out of here live, but stay tuned for the interviews.
Listening to WRIF.com.
Bill Bonds with a commercial. If you're near or far-sighted and you want to throw away those glasses forever, I know a doctor you should see. Dr. Escombati. Phone number 1-877. Then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 1-877. You see more. The equipment, the finest high-tech equipment ever made. Price $999 per eye. So don't fall for those $200 prices you hear being tossed around on the radio. Cows don't fly. Neither do those prices, unless your daddy is an eye doctor and you're getting a freebie. Dr. Escombati, no doctor we know of has a better success rate. Procedure is fast, safe, cost $999 per eye. Virtually painless, you're in and out, maybe 40 minutes. Procedure itself, maybe 5. When it's over, you'll want to kiss your glasses goodbye and hug the doctor. Or maybe you guys will just want to give him a hi-fi. Shake hands with them, walk away, and see a whole new world. See ya.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for big money. The OSI Pro Series WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Championship Series is underway, and there's still time to enter to win the $1,500 Series Championship. Sign up now for the Bass Championship going out of Lake Erie Metro Park on July 30th. Slots will fill up fast, so get your entry in now. Compete for thousands of dollars in cash and prizes, including the DMF Bait Award for the kid under 16 landing the largest fish on live bait. It's all going to be given away to the best fishing team in town, so sign up now by calling 248-591-6841 or go to WRIF.com for an entry form. There will be fun for everyone at the post-event party at Big Al Sports Grill, so call 248-591-6841 to become the OSI Pro Series WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. Brought to you by OSI Pro Series, the DMF Bait Company, Big Al Sports Grill, and 101 WRIF.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is Tomorrow's your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Hey, Tigers fans, this summer, why sit at home when you could sit at home? Plate, that is. Now is a great time to catch all the fun and excitement happening at every Detroit Tigers home game. You'll see plenty of homers by Pudge Rodriguez, Dimitri Young, Carlos Guillen, and all your favorite players. But a trip to Comerica Park means more than just baseball. While the Tigers are driving home runs, you could drive home in a brand new car during the Chevy Cobalt Drive One Home Giveaway, sponsored by your Detroit area Chevy dealers. Just buy a ticket to select Friday or Saturday night home games, and you could drive one out of here. Looking for a surefire hit? Hey, don't miss Friday and Saturday night fireworks, sponsored by Pepsi and Verizon Wireless. And with a weekend value pack, that's four tickets, four hot dogs, and four Pepsis for just $59. And you'll want to bring everyone from home. So for great giveaways like autographed balls, bobbleheads, collector cards, and jerseys, and for great baseball, this summer, catch a Tigers game. For tickets, call 248-25-TIGER or visit DetroitTigers.com and make Comerica Park your home away from home game.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
On the rock.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Riff Rock.
This is WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. As I think anybody's listened to this show over a long period of time has realized that I think that our anti-drug laws are a catastrophic failure, the war on drugs even worse, how much it's taken from our national treasury, how it's harmed our citizenry, rather than dealing with the aspects of drug use that are a problem in a creative and productive manner. As I said, it's just been a disaster. Having joined me several times on the Peter Werby Show is Ethan Nadelman. He's the executive director of the Drug Policy Institute, and it's an organization that's in the forefront trying to get some sensible solution to what has occurred over the last, now going on almost a century. So joining us from New York is Ethan Nadelman. Welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show.
Well, thank you, Peter, for having me on.
All right. The big news this week is that the Supreme Court said that it upheld the power of Congress to prohibit and prosecute possession and use of marijuana, even for medical purposes. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, basically, Peter, you know, the whole medical marijuana effort around the country had a lot to gain and almost nothing to lose from the Supreme Court case. I mean, what's important to realize is that if the Supreme Court had actually gone ahead against everybody's expectations and said that, you know, it is okay for people to grow medical marijuana under federal law so long as they don't sell it and don't have a whole commercial thing going, and that Congress can't regulate it because it doesn't involve interstate commerce, that would have been a great step forward. I mean, that would have given a sort of a roadmap for how people could do medical marijuana essentially entirely legal in the United States, at least in those states that have made it legal. Now, what they did instead was they said, look, the law is still the same. The status quo is the status quo. The states can go ahead and legalize medical marijuana, as California and about 10 other states have done, and people there will not be subject to arrest or prosecution by state or local police, which is, in fact, who perform 99% of all the arrests, you know, in the country. But that if the feds want to come in and bust somebody, especially the big growers, they can still do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's been the law all along. You know, there was a window in the last year or so where we hoped that we might even go further than that, but it just didn't go. So at this point, I'm not too concerned about this decision in the sense that it just retains the status quo, and in the sense it builds up even more momentum for political reform.
Interestingly, I think there was a lot of dogs in this fight. It wasn't just about the legalization of marijuana, but it was about the role of the courts, the whole federal system.
Well, exactly. I mean, remember, this also wasn't about legalization of marijuana, legalization of medical marijuana, right? They weren't taking up the bigger issue of legalization. But it's true. In point of fact, the justices who voted in favor of the medical marijuana proponents was Rehnquist, you know, the very conservative Supreme Court justice, and Clarence Thomas and Sandra Day O'Connor. And they did it purely on a states' rights claim. They said that there are certain areas that, you know, that don't involve the federal government, that don't involve interstate commerce, and that our Constitution intended the states to be laboratories for democracy, and that medical marijuana, whether you like it or not, is an example where the states are experimenting. And unfortunately, what happened was that two of the conservatives, other conservatives who would normally support states' rights, decided not to, and the liberals, who would be sympathetic to medical marijuana, instead decided it was more important to stop the expansion of states' rights.
Mm-hmm.
So the voting breakdown was very much unanticipated by almost anybody I know.
Well, maybe they didn't want to be activist judges either. That's the charge. Right? I mean, the conservatives like activist judges only when they're deciding for their policies.
That's right, exactly. I mean, I sometimes also think that even the states' rights thing is more or less determined by what people hope the outcome will be in terms of the actual policy area. Although here it was interesting that, you know, Rehnquist and some of the others actually stuck to their states' rights principles. And I think also in terms of judicial activism, we've seen, I mean, this court right now is may well be the most activist court we've seen since the civil rights days of the 60s.
Well, sure.
And they're very, very, very out there, and they basically are activists when, they appear to like the results.
Well, emblematic of that, of course, is the election decision of 2000 that placed the loser of the popular vote, George Bush, into the White House. But that's something,
well, exactly.
That's something else.
If you're going to be an activist court, you think you should at least try to line up a 9-0. I mean, that's what happened with Brown v. Board of Education, the landmark decision 1954. If you're going to be activist and come out with a 5-4, that really casts a lot of questions about raises a lot of questions about the Supreme Court's basic legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, back to this point right here, Peter, is that on this case, I mean, essentially, the USA Today, of all the news, I mean, everybody had it on the front page, the New York Times, USA Today, LA Times, and such, but USA Today, almost the entire first and second page was devoted to this issue, and then they had an editorial, and this is kind of America's newspaper, and their editorial just slammed the hell out of the Supreme Court. They said they were retreating into reefer madness on this stuff, and they basically called for, much more serious action to basically end the criminalization of marijuana, at least for medical purposes. So I think we're seeing some backlash already against the court's action, and we're already seeing like the Attorney General of California and others saying, look, this Supreme Court decision changes nothing. It's still legal under state law in California and other states. We're still going to enforce this law, and we're going to do whatever we can to prevent the feds from coming in and, you know, violating state law.
Ethan Nadelman is my guest. He's the executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, and we have a little game we play. People can tell you're in New York City because we just heard the sirens. And
yes.
There has never been a New York City guest where we haven't heard sirens in the background.
It seems to be an omnipresent city. You just kind of get used to it, you know?
You don't
quite relax unless you have that sound in the background.
Well, let's get on a little to the language of the majority. On the face of it, I mean, I would have liked to have seen them allow medical marijuana, obviously, from what I said at the beginning. However, since they were the concerns were other than whether people had the right to prescribe or receive marijuana as a medicine for themselves, there were these federalist and states' rights issues, and it didn't seem on the face of it like the worst decision in those terms. However, mm-hmm. I thought that the language that was written for the majority by Justice John Paul Stevens was interesting. They didn't condemn it as the scourge of youth or that this was going to be the thin wedge that was going to allow heroin to be peddled in the schools. They said, hey, go to Congress, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's exactly right. I mean, when you look at old Supreme Court decisions, not so old, in fact, you tend to see this reefer madness-like language, this kind of drugs is the great epidemic destroying our nation, as if there are not, the 5 or 10 or 20,000 people who die from drugs each year is the single greatest threat in America. Now, it's a serious public health issue, but the notion that it's, the greatest challenge to America is crazy. And it was nice to see the Supreme Court sober up a bit. You know, they stopped using that language. And Justice Stevens, who wrote the majority decision, seemed to express a bit of remorse about the consequences for Angel Raich and Diane Monson, the two medical marijuana patients who were involved in this. And he almost invited Congress to take affirmative action in this area. So, look, let's face it, 70 to 80% of all Americans today believe that marijuana should be legal for medical purposes. Even in Alabama, a recent poll showed 70 to 75% supporting it. You know, in Detroit, you had this medical marijuana coalition led by a fellow named Tim Beck, who got a local referendum passed to legalize medical marijuana in the city of Detroit. So you see, and even a majority of Republicans support the legalization of marijuana for medical purposes. So, the justices are not immune to this, and they are not beholden to the same sorts of anti-drug zealots which are driving the Bush administration's policy in this area right now.
Mm-hmm. And there is still reefer madness, but it's not the reefer madness are really the zealots. And who does this represent? I mean, who is left that really wants to take terminally ill people or people that are suffering greatly? Which I was thinking about Rehnquist as well, who's suffering from cancer right now. I mean, that may have changed his mind a little.
Well, Peter, I'll tell you, last night I was on the Jim Lehrer NewsHour debating this issue, and the person that they put up against me, it was a woman named Calvina Fay from something called the Drug Free America Foundation. And when you look them up and say, who are these people? Who are these people? She's the one, Montel Williams goes on, the talk show host, went on the O'Reilly Factor a few months ago. And even O'Reilly goes, look, Montel, you got MS. You smoke marijuana every day. There's no way I think the government should turn you into a criminal. And O'Reilly asks Calvina Fay, what do you think? And she goes, no, it's still got to be illegal. He's still got to be a criminal. So I'm up against her debating her yesterday, and you check out, and who are these people? And you go to the websites, and what you begin to realize is that they were previously known as an organization called Straight or Straight Inc. Mm. It was one of these coercive drug treat programs where parents who were freaked out about drugs would send their kids. It turned out dozens of people in this program ended up committing suicide. The program was eventually shut down as a result of lawsuits. But the principals in that organization, were a couple named Assemblers, Betty and Mel Assembler. You would think they were just kind of fanatical people who anybody would ignore, except Mel Assembler happens to be the former chairman of the Finance Committee of the Republican National Committee, and as a result of his contributions, received ambassadorships to Australia. And in fact, he's currently the ambassador to Rome. So what you have are people who are truly, truly fanatical, who have oftentimes fairly sordid past in this area, but who are politically powerful. And that's that's not the only thing driving it. I mean, there's obviously a lot of inertia. There's all the whole drug war establishment. There's all the cops and prosecutors who think they can't sound, quote-unquote, soft on drugs by supporting medical marijuana. But, I mean, there is a fanaticism that's almost unbelievable that really does lie behind this stuff.
Well, I mean, obviously, pardon me, the drug war, so-called, is a key component of the prison industrial complex, too. You start making drugs legal if you take a completely libertarian approach to it and address it only as a public health policy issue for those people, that small minority of people that actually abuse drugs and hurt themselves and need the help of society. Well, you're gonna, they think, well, you might not need as many prisons. Now, what's the percentage of people in state and federal prisons that are there for drug offense?
Well, I'll tell you, the easiest way, Peter, when I'm trying to teach about this or get people to register these numbers, because generally people, you know, you hear one number, you hear another number, just goes in one ear, not the other. One way to think about this, the United States, we have 5% of the world's population. We have 25% of the world's prison population.
Oh, man.
Okay? So basically about 2.1, 2.2 million people are behind bars in America tonight. I'm going to spend tonight in a jail, a state prison or a federal prison, which is basically a quarter of the roughly 8.5 or 9 million people incarcerated all around the world, right? So 5% of the world's population is America, 25% of the world's prison population. Secondly, of those roughly 2 million people behind bars, about a quarter of them are there simply for violating a drug law, you know, for possessing, using, selling, growing, making whatever, marijuana, cocaine, some illegal drug or another. Right?
Mm-hmm.
In addition, you have hundreds of thousands more people who are there because, you know, they're addicted and they were committing, they're engaging in prostitution or shoplifting to support their habit. Or they're drug dealers who started getting violent to resolve disputes and they land up hurting one another or a cop or a bystander or whatever it might be. And in addition, you have people on probation or parole, you know, who get picked, you know, for some petty offense, not a drug offense, and then they get picked up because they have a joint or because they handed in a dirty urine, you know, when they were being drug tested, and they land up getting sent behind bars. So roughly, you're talking about roughly a third of the prison population, roughly 700,000 people, you know, of the people behind bars tonight are there for, in one way or another, because of the drug war. And although some of them are criminals in many senses of the word, you know, if you didn't catch them on this, you'd catch them on something else.
Yeah.
What's also clear is that hundreds of thousands of them are basically drug-only offenders. They're not people or otherwise engaged in robbery or theft or violent crime or what have you. So, I mean, this is all a consequence of a, you know, a drug war approach, you know, a decision that we've kind of slowly evolved into to deal with these drugs primarily through the criminal justice system rather than a public health approach.
Wow. I have a friend of mine who was convicted of a federal charge of conspiracy to deliver controlled substances. He's been in federal prison since 1989. Will get out. I can't even do the math here. Like 2011. And he says if he would have known, he would have killed somebody because then he would have been out much, much, much sooner.
No, it's incredible. I mean, there was some progress. There has been progress in Michigan. I mean, the organization FAM, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, helped move a minor reform through about 6-7 years ago. And then they actually managed to, you know, knock out some of the mandatory minimum penalties in Michigan a couple years ago. So, and they actually formed an interesting bipartisan coalition that was able to move that through. But this is a long, slow slog. I mean, you know, I've been working on this for a number of years. We see ourselves as a movement, a growing political movement that combines the right and the left and the center that's going to be fighting for this for decades to come. I mean, in many respects, we see drug policy reform in 2005, you know, poised more or less where the gay rights movement was in the 70s or civil rights was in the 40s or women's rights was in the 1890s or even the movement to abolish slavery and the slave trade was back in the 1830s. You know, in every case, you know, only a minority of opinion supports our side, although on some specific issues we have a majority. In every case, we're confronting powerful vested interests, you know, whether it's slave owners or corporations or bigots or the prison industrial complex. Yet on the other hand, economic arguments, including, you know, fairly conservative, you know, economic arguments, favor reform. In every case, these are issues about individual freedom and social justice. Yet in every case, our opponents bring out fears about people's women and children in order to stymie reform efforts. And in every case, foreign countries are moving more rapidly in the right direction than is the United States. So this is going to be a long-term struggle. I mean, I should just say also that, I mean, the only way it's really going to change in America is if enough people decide they care about this. You know, the organization that I founded and direct, the Drug Policy Alliance, our website is drugpolicy.org, we're trying to build a powerful national advocacy organization. You know, we're trying to become like the NRA or the ACLU or other powerful organizations that have an impact not just in many state legislatures, which we already do, but even in the halls of Congress. And that only happens if people say, I hate the damn drug war, and I want to spend at least a few hours or more of that of my life trying to do something to change it.
Well, Ethan Nadelman, maybe this is a good point to talk a little about the Drug Policy Alliance, the group that you founded. You're sort of an unlikely, on the face of it, candidate to be doing this. You've got a doctor's of jurisprudence and a PhD from Harvard, a master's degree in international relations from the London School of Economics. You've taught at Princeton, and you have books out. You would think this would be like normal, where you just be talking to people and they'd be going, "Well, man, I think
yeah. more,
you know." How did what's
well, Peter, I'll say, I mean, even odder is that what I did before doing this was I actually got a security clearance and worked in the State Department's Narcotics Bureau in the mid-'80s, and I went around the world interviewing DEA and foreign drug enforcement agents, and I wrote a book called Cops Across Borders, which actually the DEA guys like and have recommended they use in their training courses.
Wow.
It was really about, you know, so I got to know the guys in the Treasury Department, the Justice Department, the State Department, what have you, who were working to enforce the war on drugs. And I got to see that those guys were not so different than almost anybody else. You know, some of them were real jerks, and some of them were decent people, and some of them had no qualms about what they did, and others did have qualms, and some of them were true believers, and most were not. And they all knew that the war on drugs was going to be, you know, as one of them said, well, a few of them said to me, I know that if my kid wants a job doing what I'm doing 20 or 30 years from now, there will be jobs available. They knew it was sort of a futile effort. But I really got to understand and I even empathize with the guys working on the law enforcement side. And I don't tend to blame them. I mean, their job is to enforce these laws. The thing really is that we're talking about a political process and we're talking about a history that, you know, the more you read about it, the more you understand about it, the more you realize how illegitimate it is. You know, you understand that the first anti-drug laws in America had so much to do with race and racism. The first anti-opium laws were directed at Chinese minorities and migrants in Nevada and California in the 1870s and 80s. The first anti-cocaine laws were directed at blacks in the South 100 years ago. The first anti-marijuana laws were directed at Mexican-Americans and Mexican migrants in the Midwest in the 20s, right? So we know that racism played a key role in why we decided to treat certain drugs with a criminal approach rather than a legal regulatory approach. You read the hearings held in various state legislatures and Congress when they criminalized, for example, marijuana in the 20s and 30s, and you think it's like a comedy skit. You can't believe the sorts of things they're saying.
Like,
you
know, what? Like what?
Well, I mean, basically the things that, you know, you smoke a joint and you go out and commit rape and murder and you have uncontrollable impulses to do that. I mean, and some of these types of opinions even penetrate into Supreme Court decisions over the last number of decades. So the disparity between what science and hard evidence and health policy objectives say on the one hand and what our actual drug policy is on the other hand is absolutely extraordinary.
Well,
which, you know, you also, just one last point, you also find that there's never even an inkling of trying to do some sort of cost-benefit study. Congress or state legislatures say, let's double, triple, quadruple the penalties. Let's say anybody who sells 2 grams or 4 grams of crack cocaine is going to get a mandatory minimum of 10 years or 15 years. And nobody stops to say, well, wait a second, what's going to be the impact of that? What's that going to cost the taxpayers? How much would it cost to do drug treatment instead? Why do we need a penalty that long? Why should we be punishing somebody who does that more harshly than somebody who commits rape or second-degree murder? None of those questions get asked in the hysteria in which these drug laws are passed.
Well, certainly the Drug Policy Alliance does. And, pardon me, I'll have on my site, drugpolicy.org, the link to it, and also, or you can go directly to it. Maybe there's some modesty here. You didn't entirely answer. I just like I can't imagine you losing a debate, I can't imagine you not being a successful defense attorney or whatever. I mean, why? Why this? Why?
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, I appreciate the personal question, Peter. I mean, part of it was I thought about being a prosecutor, and I thought, you know, I don't mind going after bad guys who are raping and stealing and killing or committing, you know, engaging organized crime or serious white collar violations. But I could not envision myself prosecuting people for nonviolent drug offenses. So that was closed off. And then as a criminal defense attorney, you know, that seemed like something that could be interesting. But I also didn't like the idea of also spending my days representing a lot of people who really were bad people. I mean, I believe in the system, but that's a job for somebody else. And I was a professor at Princeton for 7 years, and I started speaking and writing about this stuff. But I guess there's a part of me that was always interested or driven towards more sort of mobilizing, being involved in a fight for freedom and social justice. You know, it may have had to do with the fact that my dad was a refugee from Nazi Germany and, you know, then became a rabbi and you know, was a teacher in his own way. And I think I've tried to role model myself a bit or to follow in his footsteps. I think also that there was a sense of wanting to engage with the political issues of the day, and that when you looked out there, so many issues, it seemed to me, you know, had begun, issues of social justice, freedom, had really begun to get into the gray area, where there were legitimate claims on both sides and the nitty-gritty, but that when you looked at the drug war, you realize that this issue was still really black and white. We weren't in the gray area. The notion that this war on drugs really does represent a fundamental evil in American society and international society, I think it's really it reflects the dark side of the American psyche. And trying to understand that and to uproot it and to educate and to enlighten people and to try to start to mentor other people and build something around this, I mean, that became, I think, I realized over time the most meaningful thing that I could do with my life, and I feel that I've been blessed to be able to pursue what feels like a calling in this regard.
Well, I think you've done wonderful work, and hopefully you'll be out of a job in a little while that will get rid of this reefer madness in the new sense of it. But Ethan Nadelman, we have like 2 minutes left, and let's return at the end of this conversation to the Supreme Court 6-3 decision, which essentially, or as they put it, was a reassertion of federal authority to control marijuana growing and distribution. And you said that this isn't going to be enforced. Now, I know that there was a hospice, a marijuana hospice, in Santa Cruz that was like raided.
That's right, Peter. We've actually been the lead on that case. It's called the WAM, Women's Alliance on Medical Marijuana, and headed by Valerie and Mike Corral. And she's really been the sort of Mother Teresa of the medical marijuana movement. And obviously, you know, they are worried. They are worried about federal authorities coming in to bust them now. That was a nonprofit cooperative arrangement, essentially a hospice. I mean, really a hospice. And it's horrible. When the DEA agents raided her place, one of them was actually heard to say, "What the hell are we doing here?"
Huh.
I mean, it's not even that those guys feel good about it. And somebody supposedly indicated, you know, where do you think the orders are coming from? Washington and John Ashcroft and the White House and what have you. But, you know, there is a possibility here right now. The Congress in Washington is going to be discussing a bill in a couple weeks called the Hinchey-Rohrabacher Amendment, which it essentially would prohibit the Justice Department from spending a penny to go after medical marijuana in any of the 10 states that have made it legal. Now, what I'd strongly encourage your listeners to do is to go to our website, drugpolicy.org, sign up for our action alerts there, and be ready to reach out to your congressmen and your senators on this issue. Because if they get enough notices on this, if they get mobilized, you know, they will respond. And the other thing I would just suggest is that, you know, you do have a good normal chapter in Michigan, headed by a fellow named Tim Beck, who headed this medical marijuana ballot initiative in Detroit last year. So there is local action that one can engage in, and there also is national action. It's the only way things are going to change.
Well, Ethan Nadelman, thanks so much for joining us. Again, drugpolicy.org. You can go to my site, peterwerby.com, and I'll have links as well. Thanks for spending the time with us.
Okay, Peter, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
This is WRIF.com. Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix.
the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now. 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Motor City Harley Davidson Harley Fest 2005, presented by 101 WRIF, Molson, and Jerome Duncan Ford. Your chance to nab a 2005 Harley Davidson Custom XL 883 Sportster.
Yeah.
Then park it in the driveway next to a sweet new Ford Harley Davidson F250 truck, and the glove box stuffed with $5,000 you sold hard. Yes.
Compliments of Rock Financial.
Just keep your radio locked on 101. The Rift to win a key. Along with tickets to see Tesla Friday, June 17th. Also, listen for details on Harley Bike Nights around the Motor City, where you can grab a key in person.
Yeah.
Harley Fest 2005. Presented by Motor City Harley Davidson.
Feel the freedom at the number one dealer. Located in Farmington Hills.
Molson.
Making friends since 1786.
Jerome Duncan Ford.
Michigan's number one Ford dealer. Security provider. By Gallagher Security, trained professionals for crowd safety and management.
101 WRIF.
Riff Rocks.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants. Like Clubhouse Tavern, located in the fabulous Fisher Building, offering great food at great prices. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A lot of news this week, and an important event in our history. It's Watergate. We come to find out that it was Mark Felt, the assistant director of the FBI during the Watergate scandal, who was admitted to being deep throat. He was the source of all that information that the Washington Post investigative reporters Woodward and Bernstein used to get the key elements that finally drove this president from office. I mean, he quit because he didn't want to be impeached. Joining me to discuss this and some further implications that still resonate today is old friend Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon is the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and it's from there that I get many of my guests. You can go to accuracy.com. I'm sorry, accuracy.org, and you won't be able to, they don't have the phone numbers there, but you'll see a lot of very, very interesting press releases that are good information in and of themselves. Norman has also been the author of numerous books. He's a syndicated columnist, and he has another book about to come out this month, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. From San Francisco, a pleasure always to welcome Norman Solomon to the Peter Werbe Show.
Hi, Peter. Well, it's great to be back with you.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was thinking here where probably a great portion of our audience maybe wasn't even alive during Watergate. So that was, it began in the early 70s, so you would be, 32 or 33. And when did, when was it 1973, right, that Nixon, I'm even forgetting it myself. So maybe we need a recap here.
Well, you know, it's been said that history is a first draft, or rather, journalism is a first draft of history.
There you go.
And the reality is, for a lot of people, journalism becomes the only history we ever get, particularly about events that are occurring in front of our eyes or in front of journalists' eyes or just retrospectively. So that's just to say that we've been getting a crash course in Watergate in the last week or so, and a lot of it is just with big holes in it. For instance, you wouldn't know from the bulk of the coverage that Nixon not only lied about Watergate, he lied about the entire war in Southeast Asia. The basis for his Vietnam War policies was lies. And so if we look at that, we get to understand that when a president goes to war or continues war on the basis of deception, it follows like night after day that there are all kinds of lies being put out on a regular basis. And dare I say it, that has direct application to the current occupant of the White House, who has based this war in Iraq on lies and continues to do so.
Well, Richard Nixon actually stumbled over two whistleblowers, Daniel Ellsberg with the Pentagon Papers, that, as you indicated, Norman Solomon, was showed pretty much to everyone what a lie the Vietnam War was based on, and then Deep Throat. And I'm trying to resurrect my memory here. I think it was 1975 when Nixon resigned, just ahead of impeachment.
Well, he did resign in 74 when it was clear that impeachment and then probably conviction by the Senate was, you know, pretty much a foregone conclusion. You know, another aspect that hasn't gotten media play is that the reasons for the Watergate break-in to begin with had to do with the fact that the Committee to Reelect the President, endearingly known with the acronym CREEP, was very concerned that the Democratic Party may have some information about the illegal break-ins that the Nixon administration had been perpetrating on anti-war activists and people who were advocating for an end to the slaughter in Southeast Asia. Primary about among them at that point was Daniel Ellsberg, who the previous year had successfully leaked the Pentagon Papers. So this was an effort, again, to deal with the consequences of lying about the Vietnam War and then trying to smash people's civil liberties to keep the war going. I think it was the great media critic Gina Lola Bridget who said, I don't tell lies because it's so difficult to keep track of them. And that was a problem Nixon faced. It's a problem that the current occupant of the White House faces as well.
Well, you mentioned just as we began that there's implications of Watergate here for the current administration and how we look at the presidency. What are those?
Well, you know, this last week, Tony Blair has been in Washington, and the fact is that Blair, as Prime Minister of Britain, the closest ally of the Iraq War with President Bush, had a meeting on July 23rd, 2002, so we're talking 8 full months before the invasion, and recently leaked memo from that meeting shows that it was very well understood by the top intelligence people of Britain, one of whom had just come back from Washington, that Bush was lying to the U.S. Congress and the American people, that he had already decided to go to war at a time when he claimed he was still trying to find a solution through inspections and so forth. So that was one of the key smoking gun aspects of the release of this, what is now called Downing Street memo, put out in a major story in the Times of London on May 1st of this year. The second aspect is a quote from this top secret memo that just leaked out, and I'll read it here. It says, "The intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy." In other words, rather than what Bush claimed was taking place, which was they were trying to get as much accurate information and intelligence as they could about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, they were actually tailoring phony so-called intelligence and pseudo-facts around what they had already decided they wanted to do, which was launch an invasion of Iraq. Now, some people may think offhand, well, gee, that's history. Well, it's also about today. We've got Americans dying right now in Iraq. We have many, many Iraqi people dying as a result of a war that was launched on the basis of deception.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm reminded of, why I quote this guy is way beyond me, but is Jean Baudrillard, who said, the only scandal is that there is no scandal. Now, 30-something years ago, there was a grand scandal around Watergate, as they initially said, just a simple break-in by some Republican thugs. But here, this is an enormous story, these Downing Street memo. And I suspect that there's probably a good portion of the audience that's never even heard of this until our conversation. I think you can go to downingstreetmemo.org. I will check that as we go on. I'm not very good with the facts today, Norman.
Well,
I'm sorry.
You know, also there's another good site that I'm sure of. It's called afterdowningstreet.org, which also has the original memo. You can see what was top secret. Afterdowningstreet.org also has information about how people, including in Congress, Representative John Conyers, are taking the lead, a minority of Congress, but nonetheless demanding that Bush answer to this. There's talk about an inquiry for impeachment in the House of Representatives. You know, all the smart guys inside the Beltway, the power structure folks, they like to act like impeachment is a crazy idea. Well, impeachment is always a crazy idea until the public gets educated enough to demand a serious inquiry.
Now, interestingly, Peggy Noonan, a former Republican speechwriter and a hard right conservative, she's made the argument that the impeachment hearings into Richard Nixon's high crimes and misdemeanors, forcing him finally to resign, was extraordinarily destructive to the country as a whole and left the nation at a time when it needed leadership without it. And the rebuttal was, well, hey, what about all this stuff with Clinton? But that seems to make the argument even greater when you start eroding the authority of the president. It's it leaves the nation in a bad way, not a good way. This is the Peggy Noonan's argument.
Yeah, there's enormous belief in the authority of the president, and so many people have been dying and continue to die or come home to the United States seriously wounded because of that reverence for those in authority in Washington. It's really, I think, antithetical to democracy. If you believe that we should just kind of shut up and do as we're told, then sure, it's bad to really push at or illuminate the facts that are not ones the president wants us to know. But if you really take seriously the idea that this is or should be a democracy, then that's just a lot of hogwash. The great investigative reporter I.F. Stone said that all governments lie and nothing they say should be believed. He wasn't conflating all governments and saying they're identical, and he wasn't saying that all governments lie all the time, but he was saying that there should never be a faith that a government is telling you the truth just on their say-so, and that's the difference between kind of, you know, walking lemming-like in lockstep or really trying to understand the true situation.
Mm-hmm. Norman Solomon, as I said in my introduction to you, you're the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and on one of the releases that you sent out, you have former, is it Mike Gravel or Gravel? How does he say it?
Mike Gravel, the former senator from Alaska.
From 1969 to 1981. He said that that Mark Felt, the assistant director of the FBI during the Watergate scandal, who is admitted to being deep throat, that he should receive the American Medal of Freedom. Other people like Pat Buchanan say he's a traitor, a spoil sport. He did it out of spite because he was passed over as director. How do you look at Pat Buchanan's reaction to an FBI high-ranking official being the informant?
Well, it's worth mentioning that Pat Buchanan was in the White House during the Watergate scandal. He was elbow to elbow with Nixon, who was really a pathological liar, you could say, based on the record. I actually don't entirely agree with Senator Gravel, nor, of course, do I agree at all with Pat Buchanan. There's a third position that I think makes a lot of sense, and that is, so to speak, that Mark Felt should be given a Medal of Honor and then immediately it should be confiscated from him, because while he did something really wonderful in being Deep Throat and helping to blow the whistle on the Nixon White House and the Watergate scandal, also, Mr. Felt was a protege, an aide to J. Edgar Hoover, and in that capacity, Felt was directly overseeing illegal break-ins against a lot of anti-war activists and organizations in the United States. So, you know, it's a very mixed picture.
Yeah, and that's actually interesting. Buchanan in a column says that Felt turns out to be a toady who oversaw black bag jobs for J. Edgar, which is burglaries, essentially.
Right.
Let's continue on. We can reposition any of these subjects we've taken up so far, but let's get a little to your book, although I don't want to give away too much of it because I want to do a whole program, but you're with you on your new book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, and that's going to be out this month?
It will be out right towards the end of June.
Okay, and the pretty much the theme is in the title.
It really goes to the last few decades up to the present moment of being spun to death by people in powerful positions in the media and in Washington. This is not a new phenomenon. You know, some folks have said, gee, this is unprecedented. The U.S. government attacked Iraq without exploring other alternatives to mass mayhem and slaughter. All you got to do is go back through the last few decades, and I do this in my book, the invasion of the Dominican Republic in 1965, the Vietnam War, the invasion of Grenada and Panama, the Gulf War, the bombing of Yugoslavia, bombing of Afghanistan, and then, of course, again, the invasion of Iraq and some smaller missile attacks as well. When you really look at the fine print and see what actually happened, you find a pattern of deception through the punditocracy, as it's been called, the media commentators, the reporters in Washington and around the country, not all of them, but a critical mass of the dominant media outlets spinning on behalf of the White House. And I have not found an instance in which the president really wanted to go to war and was unable to do so. And this might surprise some folks. You know, going in the last 40 years through the historical record, I have not found a single U.S. war that was not based on outright lies.
That's, yep. I just kind of went through it all in my mind, and from what I know of history, I would agree. I wonder if you've seen the column by Robert Perry from the Consortium for Independent Journalism called The Real Lessons of Watergate. Did you happen to see that essay?
I have seen a number of his pieces. I don't think I saw that one.
All right. Now, Perry worked for the Associated Press and then for Newsweek, and he was talking about that the lessons that were learned about Watergate were that that the Republicans decided we have to control the media. And he said liberals learned absolutely nothing. They just thought, hey, this is great. We got rid of a Republican president.
Yeah.
And this was going to clear the way to an epoch of Democratic Party domination, which it did not, in fact. But the lesson that the Republicans learned is that you have to have a compliant media. But you're indicating this is nothing new. I mean, a compliant media.
Well, it is nothing new. I mean, we've had presidents of both parties in the last decades lying consistently when they wanted to go to war. And it was a big mistake for Democrats to assume that there was anything that even in their narrow partisan interests could be favored by the mass media, because what's happened more recently, of course, is that power has been accumulated by Republicans in Washington, and generally the media gravitate to power. They're really drawn to it, and the notion of the tough watchdogs really doesn't stand up to the light of day.
Mm-hmm. Now, maybe we have a lot of time left, but I just want to make sure we don't miss anything. Norman Solomon, you're off. In fact, we are recording this on Tuesday. This will air on Sunday, and by the time this is on the radio in the United States, you will be in Iran. What's the purpose of your trip?
Well, that's my plan, to be in Iran in the days leading up to and through the presidential election there. There's a national election in Iran for a Friday, June 17th, and every 4 years they choose a new president. To me, it's a fascinating process. They call it an Islamic democracy, and in fact, there are a lot of elements of theocracy in Iran, but there are also some democratic aspects. It is a contested election. And meanwhile, from the vantage point of the United States, we have the U.S. government, I think, building an agenda for war. We're hearing a lot of talk from Rice and Rumsfeld and Bush and Cheney about how the Iranian government must be prevented from developing nuclear weapons, i.e. weapons of mass destruction. We've heard this before. The credibility of Washington should have been shredded by now if we're going to be realistic. And yet I believe that this agenda is moving forward to try to justify a military attack on Iran, perhaps in the next year or so.
It would have to be an air attack. I mean, I can't imagine any way in the world that the United States could successfully launch a ground assault with the number of troops, the battle-ready troops that we have. I mean, as it is, the United States how many people are in the Iraqi army and police forces can't control an urban insurgency. I mean, Iran has a coherent and well-organized army.
Well, I think you're right. The neocons running the administration and Congress, for that matter, would love to be able to send in troops and just take over the Iranian government and overthrow the regime there. But, even empires, even the Pentagon has some limitations. I think that they, as usual, as a fallback, love missiles, and I write about this in the War Made Easy book, just the enormous affection that is transmitted through the media for these killer weapons, the latest generation of missiles and bombers and stealth aircraft and so forth, and that's the likely scenario. And I've seen it so many times in my own life. I'm 53 years old, where the launching of missiles takes place, and on all the TV networks you have the anchors and the correspondents just drooling over this use of technology, because from this side of the missiles it seems glorious quite often. We don't see people being shredded and burnt up by this product of U.S. technology. And my very deep concern is that we are on a slope again for that kind of thing to happen in terms of an attack on Iran.
Well, the argument would be, well, wait a minute, this is a rogue state. They're pretty crazy with their militant religion. This is the argument, of course.
I agree that President Bush's administration is pretty crazy with its militant fundamentalist religion, but I think we ought to have tolerance here. You know, there is this whole dynamic of, and if one were religious, one would say, and I think in a valid sense, pulling the mote out of one's own eye, or however that goes. And the reality is, the United States has nothing to write home about in terms of nuclear restraint, using the weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the atomic bombs, continuing to proliferate nuclear weapons. The spreading of nuclear arms around the world largely came from the fanatical export of nuclear reactor technology by the U.S. and Britain and Canada and Switzerland and so forth. And so we, again, and by we I mean that the U.S. media, are saying and echoing the White House message, do as we say, not as we do. It shouldn't surprise us that glaring hypocrisy is not very convincing to people in Iran or anywhere else.
Well, let me continue with the argument. We're the good guys. We're not going to launch any nuclear war against anyone. But the greater amount of proliferation, the greater their chances for a nuclear war. And the idea is that they hate Israel, and there is a lot of anti-Israeli sentiment on all levels of Iranian society. And if they could really step up their technology, maybe they even get one that could hit the U.S., who they dislike.
Well, the U.S. has been a driving force behind nuclear proliferation, both by spreading these reactors around the planet. And by the way, Iran, as a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, has adhered to that treaty for the so-called peaceful atom development. But also the U.S. has violated the proliferation treaty by continuing to develop a new generation of nuclear weapons in the United States. So, you know, if the U.S. doesn't want an arms race, it should stop stoking it. We have a situation now where the U.S. is, by its own doctrine, announced that it does not forswear the first use of nuclear weapons, even against non-nuclear powers. So the United States government is publicly saying it reserves the right to launch nuclear weapons against countries that have none, and that hardly is a way to encourage non-proliferation.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show, and we just have a few minutes remaining, is Norman Solomon, Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and the author of a new book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. That's going to be available towards the end of the month. We will revisit with Norman both when the book comes out and he's returned from Iran. Norman, how does one get to Iran? Do you just go down to your Northwest Airlines office and get a ticket? Is it that easy?
One goes to Iran with great difficulty. I have applied for a journalist visa, and after a lot of waiting and twists and turns, it's just been issued. But it's not very common for Americans to go to Iran, and I think that the more communication we can have, the better.
Now, who are you? Are you going by yourself, or is this part of project? Or
I'm going as a syndicated columnist with a couple of other writers, and I understand that there'll be a few dozen American journalists in Tehran for the election on June 17th. And unlike here, apparently there's a runoff where if no candidate gets 50%, then the top two face each other in the runoff, and that's one thing that we could benefit from, I think, in this country.
Well, we always see in our media that Iran is pretty much characterized as a theological or a theocracy, a theological dictatorship. Is there are there forces that are competing that have a democratic spirit and a willingness to let other points of view exist?
Oh, absolutely. There are candidates for president that run the gamut from fanatical Muslim fundamentalists to reformists to advocating for democratic opening. And you have, you know, newspapers have been shut down, but they also have continued to operate. In other words, there were papers in Iran that were independent enough that the government felt they needed to be shut down. So this is a constant battle. There's definitely a civic life, and it remains to be seen how it sorts out.
Mm-hmm. What's your feeling about going there as an American, and maybe weave into that answer the reason why the Iranians have the hostility that they do towards the United States?
Well, I think many Iranians, like people in most countries, can distinguish between the government and the people of the United States. It is a key point that the infamous takeover of the U.S. Embassy in 1979 that lasted 444 days with the hostages, it's usually referred to in the media as though there were no historical context. In fact, in 1953, the U.S. government overthrew the democratically elected government of Mossadegh in Iran, and what followed was a quarter century of horrific dictatorship under the Shah of Iran, including terrible tortures by the Savak secret police that served that government, which in turn was closely allied with Washington. People remember that, and when they had their revolution and overthrew the Shah in 79, there was concern about, I'm not justifying taking hostages, but just by way of explanation, there was concern that the U.S. Embassy again could be used as a beachhead to reinstall a dictator, and that's a lot of the reason why the hostage taking took place.
Well, Norman Salomon, please, when you come back, rejoin us. Your book will be out by then, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. And you can go to warmadeeasy.com. You go to accuracy.org as well to see the organization that Norman Salomon is the executive director of. Pardon me, it's pollen season here in the Midwest. Norman Salomon, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Hey, thank you, Peter.
You're going straight in the Army, where you'll be sent straight to America's latest military quagmire. Where will it be? North Korea? Iran? Anything's possible with Commander Cuckoo Bananas in charge.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hey, Tigers fans, this summer, why sit at home when you could sit at home? Fight, that is. Now is a great time to catch all the fun and excitement happening at every Detroit Tigers home game. You'll see plenty of homers by Pudge Rodriguez, Dimitri Young, Carlos Guillen, and all your favorite players. But a trip to Comerica Park means more than just baseball. While the Tigers are driving home runs, you could drive home in a brand new car during the Chevy Cobalt Drive One Home Giveaway, sponsored by your Detroit area Chevy dealers. Just buy a ticket to select Friday or Saturday night home games, and you could drive one out of here. Looking for a surefire hit? Hey, don't miss Friday and Saturday night fireworks, sponsored by Pepsi and Verizon Wireless. And with a weekend value pack, that's four tickets, four hot dogs, and four Pepsis for just $59. Hey, you'll want to bring everyone from home. So for great giveaways like autographed balls, bobbleheads, collector cards, and jerseys, and for great baseball, this summer, catch a Tigers game. For tickets, call 248-25-TIGER or visit DetroitTigers.com and make Comerica Park your home away from home game.
Anglers, get ready to cast your line for big money. The OSI Pro Series WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Championship Series is underway, and there's still time to enter to win the $1,500 Series Championship. Sign up now for the Bass Championship going out of Lake Erie Metro Park on July 30th. Slots will fill up fast, so get your entry in now. Compete for thousands of dollars in cash and prizes, including the DMF Bait Award for the kid under 16 landing the largest fish on live bait. It's all going to be given away to the best fishing team in town, so sign up now by calling 248-591-6841 or go to WRIF.com for an entry form. There will be fun for everyone at the post-event party at Big Al Sports Grill, so call 248-591-6841 to become the OSI Pro Series WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series Champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. Brought to you by OSI Pro Series, the DMF Bait Company, Big Al Sports Grill, and 101 WRIF.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Walker's Speakeasy, the West Side's hottest destination for great food, drinks, and daily entertainment, located on Beach Daily in Dearborn Heights. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.